Committee. Got a couple of routine matters to take care of, and here first, so I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 635, which requires school districts to contract for performance audits at least once every 5 years. This was invited testimony only, and so I'll close the public hearing on 635 and open the hearing on Senate Bill 960, which eliminates requirements that school districts determine necessity of students attending alternative education programs. And I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 960, and I will open up the public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 868. Roger, please. Sure. No problem. Roger, Diane, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Roger Bassett, Commissioner for the Office of Community College Services and the Job Training Partnership Act Administration. With me is Diane Bynes, Vice Chancellor of the State Oregon University System. We have before you a request to find a vehicle for amendments, or as I think of it, to find legs for statutory language that we're advised we need in order to cover a problem in our regional partnerships initiative. The regional partnerships are those involving Oregon University System institutions and community colleges. We currently have three of those funded in the Office of Community College Service budget this year, a budget which, by the way, passed the House floor this morning. The glitch is the statutory language in the university system budget in particular that would appear to say these partnerships cannot use any of this initiative money to cover the difference between university system tuition and community college tuition for students who under these partnerships are moving much more flexibly and freely from the community college to the university than we've ever been able to do. There are those who, particularly in the Department of Justice, who think someone could call the amount of money that covers that difference a student scholarship. And in the handout to you on the second page of it, way down at the very last line, right above my name and date, the university system has statutory language that says the board may award student aid only from any other fund than the general fund. The language, the amendment language we bring you would make it clear that notwithstanding that language, if there is a regional partnership approved by the two joint boards and it involves this feature of general fund dollars to forgive the difference in tuition for the purpose of moving more students faster to the university partner, that that is a legal act and raises no questions about student scholarship. We've reviewed this with Woody Barber of the State Scholarship Commission, the Chancellor's Office, with your chair, Senator Hartung, and with the Department of Justice, and would ask as a courtesy that you would amend Senate Bill 868 in such a fashion that this language becomes that bill. The only other thing we've done, also on advice of counsel, is to strengthen somewhat the existing language that authorizes the two boards of higher education to work together, and you see that in the Section 1 amendments at the very top, top of the attachment to my testimony.
There's only one amendment, dash two amendments. There's no dash one amendment?
That's correct. Okay. Appreciate very much your committee administrator's help in making this happen so quickly.
Good. Well, I do want to pass this out, but I need a couple more members. And so what I would like to do, and if you'll just, here's one. Take anybody else out in the hall. A member. Yeah. It's from Dave's. Well, Okay. This should be more members hearing. We'll come back. But so I'll adjourn the public hearing on Senate Bill 868 and open up public hearing on Senate Bill 144. Sure. Hale Walker, would you please come forward? Welcome to the committee again.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to appear before you, and I've prepared some material.
Hello there. How are you doing, Hale?
Okay, fine. Yeah, Karen, I'll put those up for you. Thank you.
I'd like to make a few remarks about school safety and recent events.
Please identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Hill Walker. I'm co-director of the Institute on Violence and Destructive Behavior at the University of Oregon. The Institute is focused on school safety and violence prevention and at-risk children and youth at the point of school entry and beyond. And our mission is to work with schools primarily and then other agencies, courts, corrections, social service agencies, parent organizations, and so on, to try and develop strategies that can respond to the needs of this rising tide of at-risk youth that are entering our schools and to divert them from this path before it escalates to the point where you have disaffected, alienated, dangerous youth who are, some of whom, a small proportion of whom, fortunately, are committing violent acts in our schools. So I would like to talk briefly about some recent events and what I think it means. Present some general information on school safety and at-risk conditions, and then speak in support of the bill to create an Oregon School Safety Center. I think it's ironic that Oregon has a law that requires every school, I believe, to develop a school improvement plan. It does not have a law that requires schools to develop a school safety plan. The events over the past several years suggest that there's a compelling need for schools to begin to systematically address the issue of school safety. If you ask the public today which they would rather have, say that they could have only one, a school safety plan or a school improvement plan, I think you'd find a clear majority that would choose to have a school safety plan. School safety among the public and parents of school-age children has risen to a level of extraordinary concern. It now ranks as one of the top issues that the public is concerned about relating to our public schools. We say and we hear after every one of these tragic incidents, such as Littleton and Thurston and Jonesboro and Paducah, we hear the same sort of questions and the same sort of answers. How could this happen? Where did it come from? What can we do about it? And you also hear schools are one of the safest places that our children can be. 90% of our schools are safe. I'd like to think about that just a minute. You know how many schools there are in this country? 125,000. 10% of 125,000, 12,500 schools that are not safe. You know how many children and parents and teachers that represents? That is a very unacceptable proportion in my view. I wonder if planes were 90% safe and it was one crash every 10 flights, how we would view airline safety and the likelihood of our being safe in flying. I also hear that this is a lot like lightning. You can't exactly predict where lightning will strike, and there's very little you can do about lightning. It's as though we have this attitude that if you can't completely prevent the possibility of a tragic episode happening on a school campus, then you shouldn't, then there's no real point in doing anything. And I think that's probably not a good basis on which to build policy around school safety. If you make it extraordinarily difficult, or even very difficult, for a young person or a group of young people to enter a school with intent to inflict death and tragedy and so on, destruction, that seems to me a much preferable option to assuming that since you can perfectly make every school safe and eliminate that possibility, that we really shouldn't do anything. The problem is of such great magnitude and complexity that it can be addressed. If a young person or a group of young people are willing to give up their lives, if they approach this as a domestic terrorism act, as a group in Denver did or Littleton, then that statement becomes true that, you know, chances are if young people are willing to sacrifice their lives to inflict violence in a school setting, then the likelihood is they will be able to inflict some damage. But if that's not the case, then if they understand that it carries great risk and it's very, very difficult to get into a school and start doing mayhem and violence, then I think that's where the impact of school safety procedures come into play. So what are the answers? I think there are three major approaches that can be used.
Excuse me, Hill.
Yeah.
Young people, welcome to the committee. Come right over here in front of us. Where are you from? Where? Highland Park. My people. Right. Nice to see you. Welcome. The man testifying here today is Dr. Hill Walker from the University of Oregon, and he does a lot of important things, but most importantly, he represents, say again, the school that you...
I represent University of Oregon, and I co-direct an institute on violence and school safety that tries to make schools safer and free of violence.
Welcome. Thank you, Hill. Appreciate it.
Sure. I think there are three broad approaches that can be considered. And one, we hear this all the time following these incidents. We need to address the root causes of youth violence in our society. What are the cultural factors? What are the societal factors that account for this? And people point to things like violence in the media and social fragmentation, incivility in our society, other risk factors, drug and alcohol abuse, and so on. And probably sometime in the next 100 years, we could have an impact on those. Other things I hear are we need to begin profiling these children and youth early and find the ones that are troubled and get them the supports and services that they need so they don't later do these things. And the problem is you can't predict which of a group of young people are going at some point to pick up a gun or build a bomb and start doing mayhem. It's sort of like having five or six frogs sitting on a lily pad, and your task is to predict which one of those frogs are going to jump first. We don't have the ability to look at a group of at-risk youth and say, you at some future point are going to going to commit a violent act. They have a higher likelihood of doing it, but picking out the one is a real problem. So you are left with taking very seriously every at-risk child and youth that you see who has an at-risk profile, which we know what that profile looks like, and giving them the supports and services that they need. And those that don't respond to good faith intervention are the ones you want to pay careful attention to. That's your best screening device, is to give intervention, support, services to troubled youth as early as you can in their schooling career. And the ones that don't respond are the ones that are selecting themselves out, and they are telling you that they need far more, that they're more likely to be more dangerous and so on. And finally, as unpopular as this sounds, we need to begin to bring airport security measures to schools. It's time to consider it. You don't have to turn schools into prison-like fortresses to vastly improve the safety of that facility. Paying careful attention to entrances and exits, the use of video cameras, the use of locker searches, the use of book bags that are see-through, the use of metal detectors in high-risk schools. Metal detectors are fine for the U.S. Congress, for courts, for district attorney's offices, and other sectors of our society. I find it difficult to believe that they are any more worthy of being protected and safe than are our children and youth in school. So I'd like to present some information on school safety and then answer any questions you might have.
There are four major sources of vulnerability to the safety of schools. Can you broke any of these categories or areas? And it has to do with, first, the design, use, and supervision of school safety. Most schools in the country were not designed with safety and security in mind. So as a result, many are literally kids when it comes to their safety. Tim Crow, who's a nationally and internationally known criminologist and an expert in both youth and adult crime, has developed an approach called crime prevention through environmental design, called SEPDIT. And he is, for example, a consultant to the 2000 Olympics in Australia to try and design the stadium and access and so on to it to maximize the safety and security of people who are athletes and managers and coaches and participants. So he worked with communities, cities, schools, or organizations that say very, very large events to do an analysis and make recommendations about how to maximize the safety of individuals within that setting or attending the event through paying careful attention to these kind of factors. Architecture is beginning to look at how design features can be built in to improve and maximize the space you're building. School architecture needs to really take a careful look at this knowledge base. Secondly, administrative and management practices of the school. The type and quality of leadership, the fact that there's a positive, inclusive atmosphere where all students feel a part of the school, belong to it, engage with it. My brother's a cultural anthropologist at the University of Colorado, and he talks about a celebrity culture that operates in schools, especially at high school. And certain groups of students get the lion's share of the institutional recognition and attention. Mm-hmm. And they're athletes, they're the top students, they're students that are gifted in the arts, music and drama, and so on. And you have this large group of students who don't seem to have access to those kinds of institutional rewards and recognition and become alienated and disaffected, and they begin to group together in sometimes very unfortunate ways that these problems are out. The size of school. The larger your school, the more problems you'll have. If a school is at or below the capacity for which it was designed in terms of student enrollment, you'll have many fewer discipline problems than if it's above that level. Full student bonding and engagement of the schools and so on. So participation in extracurricular activities and school activities generally. There's a whole list under each of these categories. I'm just giving you some bullets. The nature of the neighborhood served by the school, the amount of urban decay, whether the neighborhood or neighborhoods are cohesive. Do people recognize each other who live in the neighborhood? Could people in the neighborhood recognize a stranger in the neighborhood that they saw? The crime levels in that neighborhood and so on. Those factors, the amount of poverty, they have an impact on the school and its safety. Characteristics of the students enrolled. How many of the students have free to use lunch? The number of at-risk students enrolled, the frequency of arrest of those students, the number of school discipline referrals that happen. Believe it or not, there are middle and high schools in Oregon that have 5,000 to 6,000 discipline referrals per year of teachers sending students to the office. That is ridiculous. The academic achievement level of the school. The more effective your school is academically, the safer it is, and vice versa. So,
sure. Yes, Senator Duncan.
Before Hill, first of all, I am, Mr. Chair, and Hill, I am in really in agreement with your brother. I've been calling upon student leadership groups for years, and I mentioned on the floor the other day of the Senate that I wasn't thinking of the crime kind of thing we have today, but I'm thinking of the alienated students. And you mentioned the academic student, the drama student, the basketball player. Those people get recognition. And as a teacher, as a principal, you walk down the hall and you say, hi, Mary, it was a great play the other night, or Joe, it was a game, you know, all those things. Even the student gets in trouble, gets some recognition, you know. God, cut that out, you know. And you know, he gets his recognition, and he's not a, you know, he may be a bit of a problem, but he's not a vice's kind of a problem. And you think of those, and I used to ask students at the leadership conference every year, when the student council groups came in, I would ask them to go off and just think about it, because they would come in team. They'd say, okay, identify the students in your school who are just there. And I think there's a number of students who arrive at school in the morning and leave at the end of the day, and no one has spoken to them.
Right.
They've got no recognition, as you said, your brothers talked about. They've not gotten in trouble, and that's recognition,
right.
And they're just there.
Right.
And those people, now they're not all going to be the first offender, but that's why I'm wondering how in the world we could start getting students to accept some responsibility for their colleagues. I mean, you know, can you? I used to say to them, okay, go back to your school this fall when you set up your whole plan and say, how are we going to involve so-and-so? How are we going to make sure that someone speaks to certain of these kids? And I guess I started taking your time on this, but I keep on the harp on this. It's just one small thing, but that alienation is important, and that came out in this very thing in Colorado. Those kids felt, and that's why they're ganging up. They're trying to get to identity someplace else. And that's the whole gang concept, too.
It is.
Well, what I said, but I think it's just an important thing that we really need to be looking at.
There's a concept that's developed by the Oregon Social Learning Center and Eugene called the Eden Truly. You know, when you get these students that are alienated and rejected, don't feel accepted, they look around and see each other, they band together, and they form groups where they satisfy their needs. So the things that you're talking about,
Unfortunately, you become a member of one of these groups, say in the sixth grade, and 70% of cases you have your first arrest within 2 years.
And you can't. 70%. And you can't get out.
Yeah.
Right. Sure, I bet our own students here today in their school right now could think of students. Who no one pays any attention to them, no one cares about them, they don't get involved, and those people need help.
Right.
To the students, Sandra Duncan, former superintendent of public school, 15 years, well, we listen carefully to what he says, and we're working very hard to get him up to speed to what things are like today.
Only kidding.
Only kidding.
Generally about 10 years ahead.
Yeah, I know. Looking at the four main criteria there of where the most vulnerable are, but isn't it true that in so-called decayed schools in large urban cities, the mayhem of the killings has actually gone down?
Yeah.
So now we're dealing with a whole new suburbia, so to speak. So how do you explain that?
Well, I think 10 to 15 years ago, urban schools did something that we're going to have to do in suburban and rural America.
Okay.
They recognized that it could be a problem. They recognized that schools were very, very unsafe, and that they have to do something structurally to make it very unlikely that students could access the building and commit violence. They essentially brought Air Force-type security to bear on those schools, so that's the major reason you don't hear about it. It's not that perpetrators are seeking greener pastures. It's that they made it extraordinarily difficult to do that. So you have police on every floor. You have security officers patrolling school grounds. Teachers have two-way communication access constantly. They have cell phones and so on. They have metal detectors. They have video cameras and all these things. Now, I'm not suggesting every school in America has to have that, but I'm suggesting that vulnerable schools, whether you're in a suburban or a rural setting or neighborhood, need to begin to do assessments of these kind of sources of vulnerability and risk and make a considered judgment about how much of a safety plan do you think you need to have in place based on your level of risk. So you have two of these categories are very powerfully influenced by the external social environment and society. They are the characteristics of students who enroll in their school and the nature of the neighborhood that your school serves. Schools really can't influence that much. That's a societal set of factors, all right? But regardless of where your school is located, you can, and it's under your control, take a look at the architecture, the space, how it's designed, how it's used, how it's supervised, and the administrative and management practices of your school, and make changes that, independent of what your student body is like and where the school is located, can improve the safety of your school. And that's one of the things that I'm strongly recommending. The paper I gave you, or the paper talks about risk and protective factors, Monday, I'll be in a meeting in Washington, D.C., convened by the following agencies, National Institute of Justice, the U.S. Office of Juvenile Justice and the Delinquency Prevention, the National Institute of Mental Health, the Safe and Drug Free School Division of the U.S. Department of Education, and the Office of Special Education and Rehabilitative Services. Those agencies have banded together and are designing a safe school agenda that they're going to take to Congress for funding beginning in the year 2000. And they've asked five experts to contribute a paper for a day and a half discussion about how you build a legislative agenda that will address school safety. The paper you have is the one that they asked me to do. What are the risks and protective factors that operate at a school level and an individual student level that makes schools either less safe or more safe? So the more risk you have, the less safe your school is. The more protective factors you can put in place, the more likely you are to buckle those risks. I think you have to think of it in terms of what can be done at a school-wide level and what can be done at an individual school level. And we can do far more than we imagine and than we are doing.
Quick one. You suppose somebody will do a very in-depth study of the Littleton situation and apply all of those four criteria, for instance, that you did, and it seems to me this is a classic case study of what we can expect down the road.
I agree. I think that we will see more Thurston's and more Littleton's and more Jonesboro's. I pray that we don't.
Sure.
I worry that we will, unless we admit as a country that we have a serious problem that needs to be addressed at national and state levels, and stop saying 10% of our schools are at risk, but 90% are safe. We've got to stop saying that.
Senator Gordon.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Dr. Walker. Looking, could you put your slide back up?
Sure.
And that fourth section on characteristics of students enrolled, would you please talk about how race and ethnicity intersect in that particular category? Again, with Littleton on my mind, where clearly it appears that black youth were targeted, athletes were targeted. This is a shooting that happened on Hitler's birthday.
Was it also the anniversary of Oklahoma?
I believe I heard that as well.
Right.
But could you talk, again, because Oregon is becoming more diverse demographically, we know that many of our schools around the state are challenged with racial and ethnic conflicts, and we have not found a way to get in front of that. How do those factors fit in your list of characteristics of students enrolled? Shouldn't it be on the list?
It is on the list.
Okay.
It doesn't happen to be on this list.
All right.
It is on the list. Students who feel discriminated against and alienated are not likely to bond to the school, have a positive experience, have positive attitudes, quite understandably so. We know that students of color are much more likely to be victims of violence than they are to be perpetrators by any standard. Racism is one of the factors that the American Psychological Association has identified as needing to be addressed in order to reduce and deal with youth violence. So you're absolutely right. I'm not an expert on that topic,
mm-hmm.
but I know the literature with respect to what I just said.
And I really appreciate the way that you've responded, and I think that we all need to become experts. And again, because of the growing diversity in our state, there are some challenges in front of us that we are not prepared to handle. So I just want to say that for this record and in this setting. And perhaps at some point we might want to invite in someone who can enhance the presentation that Dr. Walker is making to us this afternoon.
That would be good.
In fact, Senator Gordley and Hill, I'd like to have you come back before this committee when you get back from Washington, D.C., and share with us what you learned back there, because there isn't anything that's more timely in education. I can say 4 years ago, the most important thing to parents about their kids was the quality of education in their school. Today, it's the same thing.
Safety is my job. Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. And so, would you please schedule a Jan a time that you can come back here? You may be gone by the 1st of June. Uh-huh. But most likely, you'll still be here.
Probably not.
Probably not. Just after the...
They sent me the 5 papers, and I'll take careful notes and try to do a synthesis of the key themes that emerged and make that available to you in the form of a memo or something.
Thank you, and I'll speak with Senator Representative Sinceri, and we can have a joint a meeting of the House and Senate Education Committee will devote a full 2 hours to that.
I just want to say one thing. Over the noon news, they showed about Littleton, Colorado, and they said that they had video cameras every place, but not in the library. And that last Saturday, Friday night, or I think it was, that there was a prom, and they had video cameras in the halls and all that. So they're going to look back and see who was planning the bombs. But it just seems to me that it would be wise if you had one person watching those video screens, before, instead of look back and see who did the damage.
Yeah. Now, we're absolutely right. But when I make statements about bringing this sort of security and monitoring to schools, people go, okay,
we don't want to turn our schools into prisons. Yeah. You don't have to turn your school into a prison to institute monitoring. The other thing I hear is cost. You could secure every school in America for well under $1 billion, and that is 1/6 of the amount that President Clinton just asked Congress to appropriate for the war in Kosovo.
Too much.
Well, in terms of
how am I doing on time?
Well, let's see. Could another 20 minutes? Would that be 20?
More,
okay.
Way more than
thank you, because we will look forward to having you back in about 2 weeks.
Okay. In terms of future, one of the things that we start paying some attention to is what is the school like in terms of who gets arrested, how many times, and for what? What is the school like in terms of how many discipline contacts and referrals are there between teachers and the front office of students who are involved in disputes, interactions, or whatever forms of behavior that teachers feel are such severity that they can't handle in the classroom or that they require some larger sanctions. This is an example, this is a graph of 10 middle schools in Lane County, Oregon. And the red bars have to do with the total number of arrests that occurred in that school in the 1997 calendar year, not the academic year, the calendar year. So you're going from January to December. And it has been the number of students in that school who were involved in producing those arrests, and on the top of each bar, the average number of arrests who was arrested at least once. These schools will, of course, remain in England. When I walk down the halls of these two schools, the hair rises up on my neck. I am constantly looking over my shoulder in both directions because I don't feel safe. Those schools are palpably unsafe. Now, if I feel unsafe, imagine what students and their parents and teachers and others working in that school thing. If I were principal, I'd want to have this information. Now, it's important to remember, these are arrests that occur in the community, outside. This is what your students are doing after they leave you. These are not school events. These are not school events. Here is a recent analysis of 15 elementary 16 elementary, I think, and 15 middle schools that we've been involved in our research. This is the number of discipline contacts that occur between students and the front office within 1 year, which is initiated by a teacher and produces a written record that goes in the student's archival school record. Okay? Well, the good news is the elementary schools in a sample, for the most part, have low rates of discipline contacts and referrals by teachers or students to the job. But look what happens when you make the transition from elementary school to middle school. And when you go to high school, it steps up another level. So we think that in middle school, many of the students that are producing those arrests outside of school are the high-rate I won't call them offenders, but the students who have a high number of discipline referrals. If you have 10 or more discipline referrals to the front office in any school year, you are an at-risk student. You are possibly a danger to yourself and others, although I can't make any sort of hard and fast comment about that. Other than...
Yes, Senator Duncan. Senator Duncan.
But Hale doesn't skew it just a bit with the, Mr. Chair, but the elementary, you're talking about a self-contained classroom
right.
where a teacher has them the full day, you get to know them, you work with them. So probably it's perceivable that those kids are still there, and they're just being handled by that person. And that's probably the clue right there where
it's not as mature.
Right. Yeah. But it's still, I bet you, those elementary teachers could have started identifying those kids are going to be in there.
The elementary teachers can tell you who the middle school
students
will be, right?
Because they see them all day long.
Very accurately, right. Yeah, absolutely. Teachers are the ones that know these students the best in terms of their behavioral characteristics. This is something
and elementary teachers don't like to send students right off the stage. They like to pride themselves on having their own.
This is a third way to profile a school. That I've shown you two ways. The number of discipline contacts for the whole school, the number of arrests for students in the school, what they're arrested for at the time. And this is the third way. This is the Oregon School Safety Center developed by Jeff Swig, Jeff Colvin, and Larry Irvin of the Institute on Violence and Destructive Behavior that we have. It consists of 17 risk factors that the principal or our child study or our school wide assistance team, schools have, these councils can complete. Several years ago, through the good offices of Archie Rose and COSA, we were able to send this to every principal in Oregon. So we got over 400 responses back. We got a great response because of Ozzy and COSA support. And you're asked to indicate the extent to which this has happened, like the vandalism. It's not happened. It's happened a lot. You're not sure how much of a problem it is.
Could you go back to that slide, please, Mr. Chair?
Certainly.
Could you comment, Dr. Walker, on what the responses were to number 9 and also 10?
I can't give it to you off the top of my head,
okay.
but we have analyzed these data.
Mm-hmm.
We've written them up, and if you would like, I can share it with you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'll be happy to do that. I'll send it to Dan. Is that
all right?
That's fine. Yeah. Senator Dunhill,
I missed. When did you send that survey out?
I think it was 3 years ago, maybe.
3 years ago. It'd be interesting to see in a short period of time the change.
Right.
Yes, it
would. We now have profiles on this instrument by teachers in the school, by students in the school, administrators, and school security officers. Administrators are by far the most optimistic in terms of completing the risk factor scale. Their ratings show that they see the school as much less at risk than do school security officers in particular. So there's a real chasm between the ratings of administrators and school security officers within the same school. Teachers and students are in the middle, closer to your administrators than they are to school security officers.
And what about janitors?
Yeah.
Well, we've not had janitors do it. They're probably the best school.
Right.
Yeah, they can be. I'm
right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. They know what's going on. What else do you know? The senator said they run the school.
Well, I'm the school secretary.
I agree. It happens.
This is the protection exercise, and it lists a series of items or questions that can function as very effective buffers of risk and it can move. Your risk factor is move your school in the direction of less safety. The protective factor is moving in the opposite direction of greater safety.
And then there's a set of narrative questions for that.
Hill, excuse me, the senator has an
Well, I'm just curious, Hill, on this thing, because I think you're really right, but and I agree. Did you get that information back to administrators so they could see the difference?
Yeah.
What kind of response did you get from them?
Very little. You know, the early warning timing response guide that the president had completed last fall, you recall that? After the first shooting, you know, he came and gave a talk. And he said he's going to ask the Attorney General and Secretary of Education Riley to produce an early warning, timely response guide to respond to this issue. Well, he did. And I was one of 25 experts that served on the panel that produced it.
Mm-hmm.
A colleague of mine was presenting at COSA. It wasn't a COSA annual meeting, just I think it was just out recently.
Right.
And there were 100 and some administrators in the room, and my colleague asked about the early warning timely response guide and how many had heard of it, and three raised their hand. And it was sent to every school in America by mid-September of last year. So we're still not taking this issue seriously. We're still not admitting that we have a problem. And I don't know how many more Littletons and Paducahs and Harrisons it's going to take for us to admit.
Well, how did you get the state superintendent? You know, I think people's attention span is very good right this moment.
This is a critical time to
right. You know, I hate to say it, but another month.
Yep.
You lose it. Senator Gordon?
If we can go back again to your previous slide, yeah. And you know, this is just...
The protective factors one?
Yeah. You know, one of my frustrations this afternoon, frankly, is that, you know, we're limited in the amount of time that we can spend talking about a subject that we really should be spending all day and all night talking about and acting on, and so I just need to say that out loud for myself. Number 7, student preparation for crises and emergencies. What did you get back? What did you hear?
Again, I can't say off the top of my head. But
this was 3 years ago.
Right.
Right.
I will.
Is there anything more current than 3 years ago?
No, so what I'm hearing you say is we need to do this again.
Right.
See, this is one of the things, we're here to talk about Senate Bill 144 and creating an Oregon School Safety Center.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fine example of one of the things that center could do, provide you timely data and statistics on measures that have to do with school safety and violence prevention so that we know. We have the ability to profile a school in such a way that you can get a wonderful, complete look at the how that school is arrayed on the dimension of risk. Just providing the profile to a school could have a major intervention effect, but schools are not getting that information. Schools often think they're safe, and they're anything but safe.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here to strongly urge passage of this bill. Oregon School Safety Center could translate the best knowledge and information we have on school safety and violence prevention into forms that administrators, parents, teachers, and others can use. It could be a repository of expertise and technical assistance to train school personnel in these kinds of approaches. So, you know, it's time we start talking about this.
Right.
And did something about it.
Just while I think of Hill, Greg McMurdo is seated in the back there. I think he's been here most of the time. And Ozzy was here. He's gone. And I'm going to be meeting with Superintendent Bunn at 3 o'clock on another matter. But would you and Greg get together and see what we should do, the Oregon Department of Education, for the 198 school districts on Monday, getting this kind of information out that you've given us so that as Senator Duncan says, if we don't do something now in 4 weeks, we'll forget that we had a little thing.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I was just thinking of the crisis thing that went from the president to every school.
Right.
You know the interesting thing about that? It's just kind of like the legislators. If you think of your mail every day,
yep.
And the last thing that we can do is just send something out. It's not going to work. It doesn't work with us. It doesn't work with school administrators. It's got to have a punch someplace to get.
Hey, Hill, we got about 10 more minutes, and we have to.
And okay, we've got to shut up for a minute.
Please,
this is a figure that I think you might find interesting. This has been. Was developed on a sample of 200 at-risk boys at the Oregon Social Learning Center, and then it was replicated, and it replicated perfectly, by the way, on 1,200 boys that went through Steve Carmichael's Lane County Youth Services Program.
Yeah.
You know, that's the Department of Corrections.
Right.
Here you have, along the bottom, a list of the number of risk factors that a young person, an adolescent, is documented as having from their records and so on. This is the number of juvenile detainments that they have as well. And what you find is a very strong relationship between the number of risk factors that a young person has and the number of juvenile detainments they have, that is, they're being seen by public safety and corrections. Keep in mind that conservatively, one arrest for every 10 arrestable offenses that a young person commits. We're not very good at detecting and arresting youth who are committing the offense. 1 in 10 we get. So, the risk factors might surprise you a little. Mother ever arrested, father ever arrested, documented involvement with child protection, that's for abuse. Okay? At least one family transition, which means death, divorce, family upheaval, some sort of major family trauma. Have you ever received special education services? And finally, you are an early starter with antisocial behavior. From the moment you enter the schoolhouse door, you have a very aggressive antisocial behavior pattern. Any three, and it doesn't really matter what the combination is, any three of these puts you into an ozone layer of risk for future delinquent acts and some kind of violence. Now, this is for 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old youth. This is too late. This is way, the horse is so far down the road after having left the barn that you can't even see it. You know, we have to protect society against segments of this population who are dangerous and violent. But you need to begin addressing them early on in their lives. And I'm just a couple more minutes. Here's how they end up where that figure showed it. These kids start off early in their lives, getting exposed to an array of very powerful risks that operate as family, neighborhood, school, and societal factors. Poverty is the overarching powerful risk factor. Poverty is associated with all kinds of other risks that have a tremendous impact on children. So if you're exposed to these risks from the moment of birth, it produces or leads to what we refer to as maladaptive manifestations of that risk. Defiant of adults, you're not ready for school, you have a coercive interactive style, you're very aggressive with peers, you don't have good problem-solving skills, and so on. Nobody taught you or modeled them for you. Okay, that leads you further down this path towards what we call negative short-term outcomes. Truancy, rejection by teachers and peers, your low achiever, high number of discipline referrals in school, large number of different schools attended, early involvement with drugs and alcohol. You have your first arrest generally before the age of 12. Well, if you stay on this path, then you get to the good time macro outcome. And you can see, I think, school failure, dropout, delinquency, gang membership, drug and alcohol use, violence, adult crime, lifelong dependence on the welfare system, and higher death and injury rates as a result of this unfortunate life path that you've chosen. The life chances of these individuals are greatly diminished. They're very costly to our society and to those who are involved with it. Every school needs to think about three types of interventions that are linked together that address the three kinds of kids that you'll see in any school. In any school, you'll have kids that are getting along and doing all right, 80 to 90% generally. You'll have kids in the yellow zone who come to school already at risk because of these risk factors they've been exposed to. And then you'll have kids up in here that are going to be delinquent, they're going to fail school, they're going to drop out, they're going to create all kinds of grief in school, some will join gangs. You need to use universal interventions here for everybody. Social skills training, academic expectations, eliminating discrimination from schools, alcohol, tobacco, and drug education, teaching every child to read by the end of the third grade. This is a statistic you might find interesting. The state of Indiana projects how many prison beds it will need 12 to 15 years out down the road by counting the number of non-readers in the third grade. Very efficient predictor. We have about a 25% reading failure in our schools, I believe, and it's an outrage. There's no excuse for it. We know how to teach most children to read well. And yet we allow people to use techniques of teaching reading that are extremely inefficient, ineffective. There are proven ways to teach reading that are vastly superior to others across all kids. You need to do universal intervention to address the needs of the whole school population, specialized intervention to address those at risk, and everything you have, plus case management, working with parents, community services of all kinds, mental health, to deal with that top group. This is just one of the things that schools can do to address the needs of the student population. The other things that schools need to do is take a look at the physical setting, how it's used, set up, designed, supervised, and also how the school is set up administratively, administered, operated, you know, so on and so forth. One of the difficulties of inviting a professor to you get lectures and soapbox.
I'd like to say one thing. I just want to speak for the people like my dad. Dirt poor, divorced home, 14 farmhouse to earn his living during the Depression, never even gotten a speeding ticket. And there's poor people down in outer cities.
Right.
Somewhere there is a moral compass that the schools and all your counseling can't connect if you don't teach them right from wrong. And then there's the kids, I don't know if it's Benson High School or whatever school in Portland, top class president, student body president, goes out and robs and...
Oh, robs, right.
Some of these predictors may be predictors, but someplace along the line, it used to be in the textbook, the kids learn to read, not only with phonics, but with moral right and wrong, and how to treat your fellow person.
We've lost
and we've moved all that out and brought in the social services and sort of taken away the personal response, whether you live in public housing or a nice neighborhood or a poor neighborhood, there's still the kids are responsible and they can make it.
One of the things that I want to, I didn't have a chance to speak to, but there's a wonderful program we endorse all the time, and it's called Second Step. And it teaches violence prevention skills. And it teaches four skills like reading, math, science, you know, social studies. And they are having empathy for others, being able to resolve conflicts without having to go to someone else all the time, learning to control your anger, and impulse control and problem solving. Every school
every school, I'm sorry, we're going to have to make room for it. I know we're heavily into school reform, but we're going to have to make room for teaching that kind of subject matter content because it is not being taught in children's homes. You know, taking a look at the K-12 curriculum and trying to make any changes in it is sort of like invading a medieval castle that has alligators and the moats and, you know, all kinds of things. It's the most amazingly guarded.
Okay, Senator, one last, and that is, I couldn't agree with you more on the reading. We need to teach our kids a method that has a record of success, and I have to say again, it was Senator Kitzhoffer that even vetoed the bill that would say most proven record of success just had to be available in the schools. Phonics, and he vetoed.
I know. It's just
right
amazing.
Right.
Okay, moving right along. I bet you're familiar with Mayor Jim Torrey's Ready to Read.
I am.
We had great testimony from him, and they used phonics in that.
Sure.
That's a teaching situation. Senator Castillo and then Senator Duncan.
Thank you. Senator.
And then Senator Gordley.
Hi, Dr. Walker. It's so great to have you here. It's always so, you know, interesting to hear the information that you share with us. I share my colleagues' frustration in that I really wish, you know, at some point we could just have a Hill Walker seminar for all legislators here, because really your center has done so much important work in this area of violent behavior and helping to turn kids around and really step in and really change what happens in schools. And I know there are a lot of different programs that you've been working on. You talked about second hits, but I know you also, in the interim, we had first
right.
that was before
right.
our committee, and that was fascinating to learn what a difference that's making.
Right.
And apparently there's an effort, I was talking with Senator Bryant in his juvenile crime prevention
right.
package that I'm hoping that's going to be a...
We're really encouraged by that, and thank you for introducing
great.
It and for your support.
Absolutely. So, I wish we could spend a lot more time on this, because we all need to learn a lot more about this and how we can take up some of these programs, put them in our schools, and really, really change things. So, thank you.
Well, given the nature of the topic and the way I presented, you'd have to have a lot of high caffeine coffee.
Senator Gordon? No, that's fine. No, you're next.
Well, several comments. Are you aware of any recent statewide survey that would tell us how many of our statewide public schools have some form of conflict resolution skills program?
Again, that's something that a school safety center could do easily. That would be a natural... No, I don't know.
Okay, I think this is a question that we should also address to the State Department of Education, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair, and I will also just say that every session going back to 91 when I first came in to the legislature, I've introduced a bill or bills that dealt with conflict resolution.
How do you really? Good for you.
And the need to get this kind of program into our schools. And I am a firm believer that we can spend more time on this subject matter
right.
if we choose to do that.
Right.
We can do that this session.
Right.
The time constraints that we are living with are time constraints that we've given ourselves. They can be removed if we decide to remove them.
Right.
That's the choice of leadership. And, Mr. Chair, my suggestion for you and for all of us is that, given what has just occurred in Littleton, and recognizing that this kind of tragedy is going to happen again, none of us want to see that, but it's going to happen again, we need to look at every single piece of legislation that has been introduced this session that has anything to do with child safety, student safety, get those bills all together and in some form of hearing, either through this committee, the Senate Education Committee, or some other committee, some forum, some legitimate forum that allows us to hear those concepts and act on those of merit. We've got to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And leaving here with a budget, you know, yes, that is our fiscal responsibility as legislators, that's our charge, is one thing. the leading here, having done something about the safety of our children, is quite another thing. And what I'm feeling on today after Littleton is it's like we're just kind of easing back into that zone that says, yeah, it happened, and yeah, you know, it's going to happen again, and oh, what can we do? We have got to act. There are some things that we can do. Some of them can happen legislatively. But we've got to do it. So I plead with you to speak with the Senate President and the Speaker of the House. Let's get all those bills listed. Let's figure out a way to hear them all and figure out which ones we're going to enact and get on with it. And then take up the business of making sure that every single child in our Oregon community knows that adults care about them and love them and want something for their future. The other thing I'll say while I'm on my soapbox this afternoon, I'm a student of popular culture, and so I see a lot of films. I don't know if any of you have seen the film Matrix.
Heard of it.
You know, popular star, young, youthful. But it glorifies guns and killing. And if you sit through this film and you look at who's in the audience, sitting there in the dark are hundreds of young white males being seduced by these horrible messages that are about killing. That's all it is. The character in this particular film, the lead character in this one particular film, Matrix, wears a long, dark, leather trench coat and has under his coat every matter of long gun, pistol, grenade, whatever. And it's all produced very slickly, in a very seductive manner. And the kids are just sitting there, eating this up. And then what do we start to see around our communities? You start to see the kids wearing the clothing that they've seen in the film, saying the words that they've heard in the films. So it just makes sense that they're going to start to act out what they've also seen in the films. None of this stuff is surprising to me. None of it. And it's not surprising to most of us. The long and short of it is to say that we've got to take the bills that have been introduced. If there are others that need to be introduced, get it done and act and, get something done for our kids this session. It's not even about who's a Republican, who's a Democrat, and all the rest of that garbage. It's what are we going to get done for our kids right now?
Just to support what you're saying, the media industry has traditionally responded to this challenge about the influence of, media exposure to violence on young people, particularly people at risk, as there's no connection. There is absolutely, disassociation between the two. And much like the tobacco industry has said for years, there's no connection, proven connection, between the use of tobacco products and the health problems that people encounter, such as heart disease and stroke and cancer. And David Grossman, who wrote a book called On Killing, which I recommend to you, says that the research on the relationship between media violence and youth violence is stronger than the relationship between use of tobacco products and health risks. So my recommendation is the tobacco company executives and the entertainment media executives go to Congress and lie in concert. Why have two separate sets of hearings?
Thank you, Senator Duncan.
Well, Mr. Chair, just some little notes I'd made that writing with Senator Gorsuch, I'll not repeat those. I'm just convinced that the violence, the games, the music, all of those factors are there. No, I think somebody ought to put in a big suit against the industry.
Right.
That would start making people
that's
think a little bit.
That's what it
if you could find a connection, and you can, they found a connection with the tobacco, I think the bigger their connection certainly could be found there. I wish Dr. Shannon were here, though, because she talks about her father and the poor. I think there's a difference.
Don't worry, she'll talk about it again.
Okay. But I think there's a difference in poor and poor. I mean, I think we've got to be very careful. The Depression, people were poor.
Everyone was poor.
Everyone was poor, and there was a healthy things came out. There's a difference in the poor and the poverty that we're thinking about. Hey, I think we've got to be careful. This drug scene, all this whole business deals with, you know, you talk about the safety, it deals with the academic climate and the results. And you know, I just see the things that you're doing. I get excited when I see something like this coming into this committee. These are the exciting things, Mr. Chair, I think, that we could be doing something about. We can make an impact. You know, we talk about class size. We also talk about school size. You know, it's the difference of a principal being able to call every student by name.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, you can have schools within schools, all sorts of things. Then you hear all this business about too much administration. Well, my darn, maybe we need some more administrators or, you know, people who care about kids who are there, who can call people by name. Moving from class to class, it doesn't do it.
Charter schools work very well in that.
Well, you don't even need that. You can do so many things that we're not,
miss that
we're not talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
Mm-hmm.
And what I don't want to see is moving kids away and then leaving these other kids there. I really think I'm with Senator Gordley that we ought to really...
I think we all agree, and thank you, and we will do that. Thank you very much, Hill, and if you would check with Ozzie and Greg McMurdo and get the information out to our schools next week. I thank you very much. And you'll check with Jan about scheduling when you get back from the conference for a joint meeting.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
One thing about me, we can do all these things, but then all of a sudden we send these kids home, mm-hmm. and their fathers or their mothers can be the road rage people and all of this, the violence too. That's a scary thing.
Right. Indeed.
Just one thing to leave you with.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Don't want a NATO effect,
mm-hmm.
which means no action, talk only.
That's yep. right.
Exactly.
That's
thank you, sir. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 144, and I would like to open again public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 868, and Roger, would you and Diane come up and give us the 3-minute version? I'm going to move on the chart now.
Yeah, thank you, Roger.
Give us the
short version. And the members of
Senator Castillo and I heard the rest of the body needs to hear.
For the record, Roger Bassett, Commissioner for the Office of Community College Services and Job Training Partnership Act Administration. With me is Diane Vines, Vice Chancellor of the Oregon University System. What we seek is your courtesy and support for amendments to Senate Bill 868, which would make it clear that community colleges and universities and Oregon Institute of Technology working together in collaboration to provide shared programs and student enrollment can, in fact, forgive the difference between university system tuition and community college tuition in cases where that encourages students to move faster and more directly from the community college to the university system. And the amendment, we've had some questions raised by council, whether other statutes might interrupt that. This legislation, by its notwithstanding phrase, would be clear, make it clear that in cases like I've just described, it's okay to do that.
Thank you. Roger, questions from the members? Okay, we've got 4 people here, so I'll close the public hearing section, session, and we'll open the work session, and the first thing we must... Okay, Senator Duncan moves the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 868. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Duncan moves
868 to the floor with a new pass recommendation.
Senator Duncan moves Senate Bill 868
as amended
with the -2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator
Gordon?
Aye.
Senator Shannon?
Aye. Motion is passed. Volunteer to carry the bill? Senator Duncan will carry the bill.
That's me.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. On this matter. You can clarify that. Okay. And thank you, Roger and Diane. Appreciate it very much. And so I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1299. Are you ready for that?
Yeah, I'll go ahead. Okay. I wonder if Ozzy's at it. Let me go see if Ozzy's at
it. Yes.
Okay. So, actually, while waiting for I asked Ozzy to give me this sheet on the 10 largest school districts, the student enrollment, the total staff, the budget, and the superintendent's salary, so we can see if there is a relationship to what we're paying superintendents based on their budget or the student population. It's just something to compare.
Hold him, you've called his name at least three times.
You said?
I told him that you've called his name at least three times.
Yeah. Ozzy? Yeah, is that fair? You should have a copy there.
Oh,
do we? Karen just handed them out, I think. Did you give everybody a copy of this COSA report? I wonder, maybe I've got the only one. Well, I'll get you copies of it then.
Okay.
All right. Okay, let's see. We have 1299, a hearing, and then 1253. Yeah. Okay. And look at this. Karen, I'll be only give you one copy, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Of that COSA report on superintendent salaries?
I don't recommend.
Oh, okay. We'll make some more copies. Yeah,
he said he's monitoring other bills and other committees.
Ozzy? Mm-hmm.
I said
he's monitoring. Maybe we'll adjourn. Go home.
Buddy,
Friday afternoon.
We better have some quick shots out.
Yeah, fine. Go ahead. Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. Hope you don't mind me getting after you every time I stand on the first day. Got baby to vote for today.
We will have to.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, let's see, what else do we need to talk about here? No, I think. So let's see. I think I have opened it on Senate Bill 1299. Senator Castillo and the head man and Lori Wimmer later. Let's come up also, Lori, if you don't mind. The three of you. Oh, incidentally, on the Hill Walker bill, and here comes Ozzy.
Oh,
yeah.
Finally.
Ozzy comes on the Hill Walker bill. We'll schedule that for a work session on Wednesday because it was just a public hearing. We have to have 24 hours notice, so it'll be work session. Welcome to the committee, Ozzy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Senator Castillo, proceed.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Susan Castillo, State Senator from District 20, Eugene. Thank you for hearing and taking a look here at Senate Bill 1299. It became very clear to me, and I know a number of us, as we went out and visited a school that's very close to the Capitol here, the name of the school right now escapes me. I can't remember which one it was. I know it's Richmond, yes, that's what it was. And we were there at the invitation of Congresswoman Hooley, who wanted to bring attention to the fact that we have so many buildings that are in just horrible condition here in Oregon and I guess across our country, and that it has become a really big national issue that lots of people in Congress are trying to shed light on. And it became clear that we really don't have a good handle on the magnitude of the problem with our buildings here in the state. And so as a result of that, talking with Ozzy Rose here, and we put together Senate Bill 1299 and think that it could be helpful in trying to gather that information around the state to give us a really good picture of just what kind of condition our school buildings are in.
Thank you. Ozzy?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ozzy Rose of the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators.
And if you were really distressed by what you saw at Richmond, I'm active with the Boys and Girls Club, and we're now raising money to build a really good Boys and Girls Club near there to help those kids. So if you have any extra money you want to donate, I'll arrange for contributions.
I understand COSA is going to make a big contribution.
COSA's executive director has, sir.
Oh, okay. Senate
Bill 1299. Actually, I did quite a bit of getting the language. And you've heard us talk, and you've been in the discussions for the 8 years that we've been involved in moving to a state school, state-funded school system. And we're creating equity in the operation of schools. One area we have not addressed is the inequity of local districts' ability to raise funds to for the facilities. That's compounded now by with measure 47 and 50. We've narrowed significantly what you can do with bonding money. We've also inserted double majority, which makes it very difficult to pass bond measures. And I appeared before the debt advisory committee this last fall, and ahead of me appeared the representatives of higher ed, who gave the debt advisory committee a very detailed report on the conditions of facilities in higher ed throughout the state. They're a single organization, they have a staff that does that, etc. And when I went to the table and talked about the long-term debt needs for facilities for schools, all I could say is, yeah, there is. I could not describe the facility situation district by district basis. And I believe that long-term, our state is going to have to assist districts in the facilities arena. We need to recognize the different wealth of districts as we make those assistance. And if you're going to get involved in the state level, you need to have some priorities. What do you do? Where do you spend whatever resources you have? And you'll never have a very good way to do that unless you know what the problem is. And this bill, by the way, Washington, I called them and got a hold of what they use for facilities inventory, and they have staff at the department because they are heavily involved in the building of buildings or facilities. A significant portion of a new facility when a school is built in a community is paid for through state funds, not through local funds. And I'm not proposing that that's where we wind up, but that's why they're very up on this certain activity.
Mr. Chair, I believe they use the state lands money in the state of Washington too, don't they?
I don't know. Mr. Chair, said I don't know where they get the money. I just know, and there's one flaw in their system. I'm from up there. I taught school up there, and I was raised up there. But they used to be set up in such a way that quite often for the local district, it was more economic to build a new building because they got more money to do that than if they upgraded an existing building. And it made for some, I believe, bad decisions. So you need to think about how we do things. But the bottom line is we're going to have to find ways to help districts because our infrastructure is very old. One of our superintendents who retired from one of the stronger suburban districts in the metro area wrote to me last year in November, and he had been used as a consultant by a district, by Lebanon School District specifically, to help them pass a bond to do their, and he was aghast at what Lebanon has for facilities given what he was used to in school facilities. They had 30-year-old portables that are designed to be used temporarily. That's what their facilities are in lots of cases. They have desperate facility needs, and they can't get it done locally. I think we have to help them. But you can't help them unless you know the magnitude of the problem, and that's where this bill heads us. I don't know, as I understand the Washington system, they have a checklist approach that a person who has some knowledge of architecture and buildings can use that checklist and person A do it in Beaverton, person B do it in Banks, and they'll come up with the same analysis so you have some consistency, and that's what this is trying to drive toward. This would have a cost. You'd have to give you fund it. I don't know if you do it this session, but I think you've got to get started thinking about the infrastructure needs and the presentation you had ahead of this. argues that we should have done a lot of other things too, that are just besides making earthquake proof and hold it standing up. And that's what's behind the bill.
Thank you, Ozzy. Lori?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Lori Wimmer, Oregon Education Association, and we support this bill and ask for your consideration of it. One of OEA's top four priorities is school safety for students and staff, and we believe that this not only speaks to the issue in terms of earthquake proofing and the structure, but also such things as the fit building syndrome and other kinds of health hazards as mold and mildew have caved in roofs, and there have been air quality problems in some schools. These have all been issues. I know one time, Ozzy mentioned Lebanon, one time I was there for a guest lecture, I think a year or so ago, and as I was walking down the hall, a child who leaned on the window from the outside caused an entire plate glass window about the size of the steering room window to cave in on the students as they were walking down the hall. Unfortunately, no one was injured, so I thought, goodness, how did that happen? And I know that that's probably not an isolated circumstance, and those kinds of things do happen. We also believe that it's a sound investment decision to put a little bit of resources into taking such an inventory in order to make sure that we aren't deferring maintenance to the point at which there are safety problems. And I also would point out the fact that it asks for a factoring in of enrollment growth, and where there is a lot of growth, I think that's an important consideration with respect to the capital side of the equation. So we, with that, I'll say we do support the bill and hope for its passage.
I know this is on the internet now, all that, and I'm a very conservative Republican, but I was in Denver, Colorado, with my oldest son, wife, and kids live in. Went to the school in Nice Mall, and I looked at my receipt, and it had how much it cost, then the Colorado sales tax, and then it had another amount. And I said, "What's this? You know, I don't understand this." And they said, "Well," and it was a big mall where Martins is out by the towards that part. Anyway, and they said, "Well, we had to put on the systems development tax for how we're impacting the neighborhood." And I said, "Well, I suppose it'll be off then when it's all paid." And they said, "No, it will be there." And I was thinking, I know I said this in Woodburn the other night, their schools are in bad shape, but they have, given that warehouse, Wehrmacht, all that space out there, and they won't start taxing those people until, I think, 2001. And they said their troubles will be over when all that money starts coming in. But the little towns don't have that. And I know, I don't know if we can just, put it on new ones or something, but we do, because they do impact, and the law says the contractors got it, they told me that you can't put systems development fees on homes and that for schools. But there ought to be some way that we can put it on something.
Representative Strobeck has a bill to do just that very thing for, it's fairly complicated, but it basically has to do with the first amount of taxes paid on a house go. I'll explain it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I was going to mention that, but there, if we don't do something about facilities, we're going to find ways to bleed it out of the school fund formula, which is the operations side, and I'm fighting Representative Strobeck's bill because of the long-range impact on the operations side, and we need to address the facilities thing right up front.
And it shouldn't be on homes.
Well, I don't know where it should be on, but we have a facilities need both for new and in the condition of our old. A couple of things I'd like to add. One, I helped the senator prepare this language. I have no idea how much money Greg McMurdo asked me how much money ought to be put in. I have no idea if you get serious about doing this, that needs to be addressed, but I don't. Right now.
Yes, this will go to ways and means.
And the third point, excuse me, Senator Shannon, Woodburn schools will not benefit directly when the Wehrmacht land comes back on the taxes.
The mayor thought they would.
No, because the state school fund formula, by act of this legislature, you capture all the local money. They'll have more local money, but you'll just reduce the amount of the money that goes through them. The money amount the schools get is dictated by the formula, and so the Wehrmacht stuff will not directly help the Woodburn schools. It will create a better tax base if they want to try to pass a building bond, but it does not help them directly.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Sure.
Thank you for correcting.
John Marshall, would you...
John Marshall with the School Boards Association. There's no way that I could possibly do a better job of lending my support on this bill than has already been done, so I won't.
Okay, thank you. We like that kind of testimony. Anyone else like to testify on Senate Bill 1299?
Mr. Chair, I just think this is another place where I think that the cutbacks of the Department of Education have hurt in the long run. And not that that makes a complete difference, but there was a time when we had a school architect on staff who was available to work with all school districts, and that's all that's cut out.
Okay, I will close the hearing on 1299, and it's scheduled for work session either Monday or Wednesday, and so we'll work it then. And now I'd like to open, a public hearing on Senate Bill 1253. Mr. Davis, please come forward, identify yourself, and proceed. And we have set aside a half an hour for you, and so it's all yours.
Which one number is this?
1253.
Well, thank you very much. It's an honor to be here, Senator Hartung, and to the before the state of Oregon's Senate Education Committee. And, you know, when you prepare and you work hard on a project and an endeavor that has wide support from so many different people, and then you have a tragedy like the other day, I had met with some of you that very day, and then the world blows up again dealing with alienated children whose brains have gone crazy, as it were, and in this case, white middle-class children, sometimes the setting for particular issues is uncanny. And so it's with that I want to talk with you about the reasons why this state needs to fundamentally address a long-term need that does not exist in being supported, so that the effective use of billions of dollars in public education can proceed. You know, there is an issue in brain development, how the brain works and how we function as human beings from the time we're little, in the way we use our childhoods, the way we rear our children, and the way in which we use our brains with media nowadays. The Oregon Media Literacy and Parenting Support Act that is envisioned in the legislation does several things. It creates the first complete K-12 media literacy education within all of the guidelines, benchmarks, and existing curriculum frameworks so that teachers can deal with the biggest curriculum in children's lives. Right now, children are putting their attention, or they're putting their brains at the disposal of media for twice as much time as they spend in public education. There are two curriculums in our society. One starts at age 18 to 24 months, and that is the effect of video games and television. The other curriculum is the one that you fund, and it is so important to realize where we are when not only we look at the tragedies that have a great deal of media conditioning on children's brains as backdrop, but also the fact that public education is stalled at whatever level of funding we seem to put together. At a certain amount of funding, you can add more money and more resources, so the governor's little conference on the brain that Senator Gordley was instrumental in hosting. We heard in Chicago from one of the presenters that superintendents of the richest districts across the country are reporting that kids are coming brain dead from rich families to school. So what I wanted to do in introducing the several people is to alert the committee about the way in which this particular act of the legislature and with the governor's signature would create a new form of education, critical thinking, using and developing the expressive and language capabilities of our children's brains, restoring pro-social, restoring decency in the classroom, and giving parents the ability to negotiate themselves in a media age for which they have really no information coming through media sources at this time. And so three things the bill does is, first of all, creates the curriculum, which is led by an executive steering committee. Did you receive copies of the amendments? Yes, so you have copies of the amendments. The statewide steering commission would be led by the governor, the Speaker of the House, and appointees of the governor and the Speaker, the President of the Senate, the Superintendent of Public Instruction, and the Executive Director of Children and Families. Then there would be a statewide council of experts, which would bring together the tremendous academic and institutional players or participants in our state to create the curriculum using all the state-of-the-art knowledge and approaches. And there is a huge body of expertise in the state. It is one of the richest that we could really have at every level, the medical level, the instructional level, the curriculum level. Then the bill also calls for mass dissemination through the state's biggest two structures in actually educating the public. Number one is the public school system, and it fully funds the dissemination through public schools of K through 12 media literacy, and I've shown you some components of what might be used by the statewide commission in terms of concepts for different modules, we call them, in curriculum. Then we would we'd also have the Commission on Children and Families working with all of the state's community groups, including its businesses, its churches, its various agencies that deal with children who are in trouble, but all of the mainstream institutions to disseminate the parenting curriculum that would be created. There does in this state exist no state-of-the-art, easily-to-obtain, brain-based curriculum. I know that Senator Gordley is very interested in, for instance, caregivers having a real knowledge in early childhood development of how the brain of a child works and what it needs to develop. And under this particular bill, the kind of curriculum that would be needed would actually be funded, and money would be included to actually disseminate it. But in all of these $150 million I've heard so far of at-risk proposals for interventions across the state, it requires that we change behavior of adults and children, but there is no uniform curriculum. There is no curriculum for parents and caregivers that is up to date and also deals with the huge media issue. So those words said, what I'd like to do is introduce several people that we have in order.
Proceed.
We have, first of all, Dr. Linda Irwin, who is a trauma...
please come forward.
Trauma surgeon. And then also Jack Scruggs, who is a counselor dealing on various levels with youth in school systems and now the community colleges. Dr. Irwin.
Yes, Dr. Owen, please identify yourself for the record and proceed. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, sir. I really appreciate being able to address you all. My name is Linda Irwin, and I'm a trauma surgeon at Legacy Emanuel Hospital. And one of my focuses in that capacity has been to focus on injury and violence prevention. And I'm here addressing this committee because I think that this bill goes a long way actually towards that end, towards that goal. And to make that clear, I want to say also I have a background as a classroom teacher and an educator as well that I bring to my support of this bill. When we look at the goals of public education, surely an overriding goal of the whole process is to produce people who can be successful citizens and participate successfully and peacefully in a democracy. And so when we look at curriculum, then everything in the curriculum really ought to have, in some fashion, pursue that end. And there are two things we can be pretty sure about young people when they graduate from the public education system, and that is, number one, they will be watching television. They already are. And number two, most of them will be parents. And one thing we know is that television is being consumed in massive quantities and it's pretty much unconsciously in our culture right now. And the effect of that has been to desensitize people to violence, which makes it easier for them to behave violently and to tolerate violence. The effect on children has been even more dire because, as Mr. Davis alluded to, the recent research in the last 5 to 10 years on brain development makes it quite clear that children's brains develop depending on the stimulation in the environment in which they live. And if your primary stimulation is to be sitting in front of a television as a passive receiver, as opposed to playing and actively using your imagination and being creative, or as opposed to sitting and reading, then obviously we're going to end up with very different brains from that passive process that essentially gives children access to unfiltered information, much of which is inappropriate for them at different developmental levels. So I think it's critical that we help our children to get the skills that they're going to need to deal with this media effectively. And I want to tell you a little story just to show you the impact of the media and what an illiterate media consumer can conclude. The first 6 months that I was at Emanuel, I had a 16-year-old boy who was in an argument that culminated in him being shot in the abdomen. And he presented to the emergency room. And as I was wheeling this young man into the operating room to fix him up, because fortunately he did survive, he looked up at me and he looked straight in my eyes and he said with complete, genuine shock, "I didn't know this would hurt." And at the time, you know, I just want to get him in the operating room, get him fixed, and I did. Fortunately, I survived. And as I took care of this young man over the next week or so, it became clear to me that this was not a particularly unusual child. He was of average intelligence, at least. And I had to go to that question, well, how could you be 16 years old and a pretty bright kid and not get the fact that getting shot hurt? Much less that he could have died or he could have been permanently disabled. And that led me to the question of, well, where do most people, especially young people, get the bulk of their information about violence in general and gunshot wounds in particular? And the obvious answer is they get it from the media. And without having the skills to discern what they're looking at and what they're viewing and understand it, the problem is that to these children, what is actually misinformation looks like the real deal. Unless you think this child is a one-off, I subsequently went to a national trauma surgery meeting and I asked surgeons from all over the country and everybody I talked to said, oh yeah, I've had that happen a bunch. So we need to have some skills delivered to our children so that they can critically view the media and so that they can critically select what they view, so that they're viewing things that are healthy for them. And we need to have a curriculum out there for parents also that helps them understand how children's brains develop, that helps them understand the influence they have on that by their parenting methods, and also helps them understand the impact of the media, because right now TV is a really comfortable electronic babysitter for a lot of parents. And unfortunately, and they're doing that, I'm sure, not because they want to hurt their children, but really out of ignorance. And I would submit to you that there is nothing in school currently, all the way up through and including graduate school, unless you elect to pursue it as an individual, there is nothing in education that teaches you about child development and what to expect as a parent of your children at different stages in their lives. And that is an absolute setup for failure on the part of parents and children to be successful and turn out peaceful, successful citizens. And I remember getting very frustrated one day with a friend of mine who had a completely unrealistic expectation of his six-year-old. You know, he goes, well, he's old enough, he ought to know better. And I said, well, that's the whole point. He doesn't know better because he's 6 years old and he's not a mature adult. And, you know, which part of your graduate degree in engineering taught you anything about your children? And when are you going to go out and learn something about them? You know, here's somebody who's very highly educated and yet ignorant about his own children. He's not a bad guy. He's trying to be a good parent, but the resources aren't out there and readily available necessarily, especially not to everyone. So I think that we need to be very clear that media currently is glibly misinforming our children. It is creating poor self-images also, particularly for young ladies, because, again, they don't have the skills to discern what's real and what's not real, what makes sense, what doesn't make sense. The things, the men and women that are being portrayed as heroes on TV are essentially sociopathic, because only a bunch of sociopaths can kill 50 people and walk away for a cup of coffee and a piece of pie like nothing happened. And we have got to do something to give our young people the skills that they need to be discerning consumers of the media. And that is not going to happen without some sort of directive curriculum. They're not springing out of the womb knowing how to do this. And it's cognitive skills, and it has to be taught, and it should be taught, because in our current age, let's face it, almost everybody's major source of information on every front has become television and the media. And it's only realistic to recognize that and then to address in our public education system specifically a curriculum to help people deal with that rationally and in a healthy fashion. Because right now, I'm here to tell you, even people with good educations are not dealing with television and the media in their own homes in a healthy fashion. It's not happening. So I'm here in support of this bill because I think in the long run this will be a significant injury prevention bill in the sense that we will end up with children that have better parents, we'll end up with children with better brains, more creative brains, better problem solvers, better critical thinkers, which we all need for democracy to continue in the future and for us all to be successful. And I don't see any way really to have that happen without some directive activity to that end. And I think I agree with Mr. Davison that Oregon is rich in resources for this project, which I understand no other state has undertaken. And so I would encourage you to support Oregon being the leader in the country in some groundbreaking legislation here that we can show other states this is successful. And this will spread, and this will end up having an impact not just on our children and parents in Oregon, but potentially an impact nationwide that could be very helpful to everybody. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Irwin. We'll hear from Mr. Scruggs, and then we'll get back to a question. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Scruggs.
Thank you. My name is Jack Scruggs, and I speak in support of Bill 1253. And although I speak as an individually concerned citizen, I hope my background education lends credence to my brief statements. I'm currently a Native American Program Director at Central Oregon Community College. Prior to my present position, I was the Education Coordinator for the Burns Paiute Reservation in Burns, Oregon. 10 years experience both as a classroom teacher and a school counselor with K-12 experience. Also, for a time, an outpatient clinical supervisor for a research institute in Eastern Oregon. In that position, I provided mental health for children. In a previous life, I was a member of the Foreign Service, serving several countries around the world, which I hope gave me a better view of cross-country cultural counseling and dealing with various other groups. I have but two brief points upon which to comment, both particularly pertain to television viewing and video games, even though I'll speak as if it's just television. Point one, it's been often said that a fish is the last animal that will discover water, or to state in less enigmatic terms, that which is most obvious is often least discernible. That is certainly one of the rules which I worked under when I was in the intelligence community. This is also applies to the television habits of youth today. Whether watching a production of Shakespeare or a program of less merit, more vulgarity, it is not only the content of the program, but the behavior of television watching itself, which presents our youth with emotional difficulties. I well remember the story of a man who was thought by a Border Patrol officer to be smuggling contraband. The Border Patrol officer could not figure out what the man was smuggling, but he was convinced he was smuggling something. And each day he would meticulously examine a large wheelbarrow, the contents of the large wheelbarrow, as the supposed smuggler pushed it across the border. After years this went on, and the Border Patrol sought retirement, and he said, "Before I retire, can you tell me what you're smuggling?" The man said, "Wheelbarrows." That happens to be a lot of what we're saying about TV.
Yeah.
So it's with children and unmonitored television viewing or video game involvement. There is much discussion concerning the deleterious effects of today's programming, too much adult content, too much violence, etc. Little, however, is said about the nature of the medium itself. Were all of programming of high intellectual and moral content, we would still have a grave problem with the viewing habits of today's children. Excessive television viewing mimics the effects of long-term narcotics use in that it diminishes the intellectual function of a child as narcotics limit the functioning of an adult. While I'm no neurologist, the research I've been exposed to strongly suggests that in watching TV, the visual stimulus enters the brain through the optic and auditory nerves, but for the most part bypasses the frontal cortex where intellectual discernment is thought to be digested, and goes to those sections of the brain more attuned to entertainment and to provoking the emotions. And I think we have an instant and credible critic to my right that can verify their research. In other words, if this research is correct, not only is much of a children's TV viewing unmonitored by an adult, but is even unadjudicated by the child. The results are patterns of approaching life's problems, of bypassing the intellectual aspects of the situation and only evoking the emotions. This distressing result of television viewing results without regard to the quality of the programming. As a mental health therapist, I have noticed this phenomenon in many young clients. It is axiomatic as well as problematic, but often my most troubled young clients were also my most voracious television viewers. And although my own experience in this area may be termed anecdotal and not research, this is consistent with the observation of over a decade working with children. So the well-intentioned parent may do a wonderful job of monitoring even the content of a child's viewing habits without realizing that the watching itself presents its own set of problems in the manner in which it teaches children to view intellectual problem solving. Other techniques, such as very rapid camera changes, make it difficult, if not impossible, for a child to intellectually adjudicate the content of either a program or an advertisement, leaving the viewer with a full emotional impact of the viewing without the intellectual mediation. The techniques of television often distort a sense of time for children and its ability to shift and change time in ways which makes it difficult for a child to learn proper appreciation of time. Under optimal circumstances, it takes about 12 years for a child's life to learn all the nuances of our particular time education. And if you ever doubt this, tell your kid that we'll be there soon. And see if you don't run up against a difficulty in terms of what soon means. These and other difficulties of the meeting itself often escape the attention of even the most well-intentioned parent. Parental education could go a long way in removing many of these deleterious effects of television viewing itself, again emphasizing that content is not the problem I'm addressing. Watching television with a child and talking with him during the programming, such as asking intellectually appropriate questions, can force a child to intellectually adjudicate the information being fed to him, thereby negating some of the harm of watching unmonitored programming. Parents can be taught this, provided we have a curriculum to do so. A second and even briefer point. In some respects, excessive television viewing mimics the effects of childhood trauma. Effects of childhood trauma can be best viewed in about three aspects: duration, frequency, and intensity. For instance, in judging harm of abuse, we therapists look at how long did it occur. The longer the duration, the more problematic the result. We look at frequency. Did it happen every day? Did it happen once a week? Did it happen once a month? This, too, gives us ideas from harm. And, of course, intensity is a good means of judging the harm of abuse. And applying these same terms to potentially injurious effects of television viewing, we might find the following. Duration. Television viewing is habitual, and as many of our adult activities. If a child watches 4 or more hours of TV every day and becomes habituated to that much viewing, research strongly indicates the reading ability of that child will be diminished. Two other problems quickly ensue. The child fails to do other things such as reading, homework, exercise, etc. In the future, a lifestyle of dubious merit, which excludes other more worthy activities, such as social interaction, schoolwork, is established. In the past, if there's been too much TV watching, much of what should have been transpired in childhood, such as exercise and schoolwork and personal relations, is neglected. So both the past and the future of the child is quickly compromised. Frequency. How quickly the above habituation occurs is in part a function of whether the child watches 4 hours or more of TV a day. The problems engendered by excessive time in front of a TV are clearly exacerbated by how much he watches each day. And intensity? Intensity has to do with both program content as well as different techniques used in recording the program. As mentioned above, rapid changes in scenes creates an emotional intensity for the viewer, but inhibits the ability to intellectually digest the content. Violent or sexually explicit scenes also create an emotional intensity, which, due to the nature of television as well as the nature of the human brain, leaves a child in a very poor position to employ whatever intellectual functions he may have at that particular age to adjudicate the situation. The constant elevation of emotional intensity then makes normal elevations seem odd and unfulfilling. The child seeks to maintain a raised level of emotions, much as a drug addict seems to alter his emotional state. Brevity does not permit us to further explore any of these questions. However, as a Vietnam vet, I can say with some assurance that nothing takes the fear out of a minefield like a map. The same applies to the present situation. Another vet?
No.
Oh.
More paranoid.
Okay. Parents, educators, and children can learn more responsible ways in which to use our media glut. Education is essential. Otherwise, like a fish which is yet to discover water, we as parents and professionals will continue to swim in our media world with little realization of how polluted and dangerous the waters really are. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from the members? One. I was glad that you got to them, but it does actually for the brain, the critical thinking skills. Because you told me that in my office, but I didn't know if they had all been told.
You know, I just one comment on that. I was telling Mr. Davis that what I've noticed, if you go to medical meetings, okay, which are people who are generally critical thinkers and good students, et cetera, there's been a change in the last 10 years in the format in medical meetings and I think other professional meetings where you used to go and sit and hear somebody speak in depth about something for an hour. Now you go and you hear 15-minute sound bites on stuff. Mm-hmm. It's almost like even the adults in the culture can no longer focus for long periods of time on topics. And I attribute that, frankly, to, again, our viewing habits and the impact it's had on us as adults. You can imagine sort of children being in that position having even a greater impact on them. Scary to think about.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator.
You know, I think we look at what it happens to us. I mean, she's mm-hmm. right. We're geared that way too. And I just can't believe what I accept today that I wouldn't have tolerated before. You get immune.
A good example of how far this desensitization has shifted our norms in this country for what we consider normal in terms of violence is demonstrated by this. When the film E.T. was shown in Sweden, they judged it could only be shown after 10 o'clock at night because it was too violent for children to see.
Mm-hmm.
In our culture, we look at that as a children's film. We don't even... The violence has been so effectively camouflaged by our media, and we've been so effectively desensitized to it that we aren't even on the same scale of things as folks in other countries are. And I think that is the best example I can think of how far our norm has shifted.
Thank you.
And Sweden also made the case that this was anti-parental
control
and proper monitoring. Sorry, Dave.
I'm sorry. We really need to wrap up here. In fact, we should have like left 5 minutes ago from this committee, and I know we have a couple of other people. If we could just do 2 minutes each, and I know that one person, I think you did we call up Rachel Osterlitz?
Dr. Tips, and then Mr. Sanchez as well.
And Mr. Sanchez, Stephen Sanchez, if you could come up and I'm so sorry that we've run out. Okay, sorry we've run out of time here.
Madam Chair, while the panel is assembling, I would just like to thank the previous panel for your thoughtful presentation and the thoroughness of the research, and just note for the record that there is a letter in our materials from former Portland Public School Superintendent Jack Beerworth endorsing this this approach, and just wanted to draw that to our attention. And then I'd also like to acknowledge Dr. Linda Irwin, someone that I have a great deal of admiration and respect for, and just thank you so much for taking time out of your busy working schedule to come to Salem as often as you do to testify on these issues having to do with safety and prevention and education. Thank you.
I'm just thinking what Senator Gordy just said, and I think how even I commented to my grandchildren, oh, it's just that, remember, this is all just pretend. But that's even a bad thing to say. I mean, it's kind of the doctor's dad. You, the gunshot wounds to your stomach, that's just pretend, it doesn't hurt. Until you're putting them into the surgery. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. I'll watch my statements to my grandchildren in the future.
Hey, would you please identify yourself and for the record? And
I'm Rachel Osmatich, and I am a faculty research analyst in the Family Policy Program at Oregon State University. I am not here representing Oregon State University. I'm here as a researcher and parent education instructor and as a mother. I've been concerned about this issue for a long time, and I think it is definitely an education issue as well as a consumer education and public safety issue. I believe, and I shouldn't go on, you probably want to hear from the identity of Dr. Sanchez.
Well, it's not Dr. Sanchez, no. Madam Chair, Vice Chair. I'm Steve Sanchez. I'm a prevention intervention specialist with Salem-Kaiser School District. Are you going to continue?
Yeah, well, if you have more to say.
I think she ought to continue, and then I'll...
Sure. All right. Well, since I have a short time, I do want to focus on certain things, and the handouts that are coming around or will come around have a number of facts, and what I've given you is boxes of facts that are related to the effects of media violence on society and the effects of media on the social development of our children and our culture. And one of the major impacts is on school performance. It is clear that children who watch more than 10 hours of television per week have an impact on their school performance, and the more they watch, the more of an impact there is on their school performance. Heavier viewers of television are more likely to engage in sexual behavior earlier, are more likely to engage in tobacco and alcohol use, and are more likely to have problems with obesity. And of course, the connection between violence and the media, and viewing the media, and I'm talking about all forms of media, electronic media in particular, is that connection, that causal connection, is very clear. And in one of those boxes, you have a list of all the medical organizations and psychological organizations that I came up with in my very brief search, who have come out publicly saying there is a causal connection between media violence, the level of viewing of youngsters, the amount of intervention of parents affects that. But that connection between children's aggression, their later criminal behavior is very clear, and I think the debate is over It's clear we need to accept it, and we need to take a serious approach to dealing with that. We need to give children the skills to mediate that, and we need to give parents the skills to support their children in that mediation. We also need, if part of supporting children's school performance, and there's all of the skills in this bill that are discussed, giving parents, relate to school performance in one way or another. So I think this is very appropriate in the Education Committee. It affects education. And I think if this bill passes with this united front, we will see a difference in school performance as well as behavior in our schools and on the playgrounds within 5 years, at least within 10 years. It will be remarkable if we do this.
Thank you.
Yes.
I just want to, you know, you mentioned sexual activity, and so I'm just thinking, if you, I'm sounding like my grandfather now, I suppose, but, you know, you watch a movie, or you watch something on TV, two people meet, and they go to bed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and how, if that's what you see all the time, that becomes the norm and acceptable behavior. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's what I think is just right now. You could say all this other stuff over here, but my goodness, if you're seeing it all of the time.
And Senator.
They used to quit, by the way, they don't smoke on TV anymore, in movies.
Right.
You did get away from that. If you think back in my day growing up, everyone, men and women, you look at the old movies, they're all smoking.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't see smoking. Someone has gotten through to them about cutting out the smoking.
That we're teaching children many different ways of behaving sexually and many different ways of murdering people.
You can cut out smoking, you ought to cut out.
Thank you.
Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, I'm really frustrated because I spent a lot of time putting this together and I'm constrained for that, and you have this.
I'm willing to stay to get it on the record. I can.
Okay.
I have my meetings before, so
I don't.
That started 3 minutes ago.
So I think what I would like to do is to tell you that you have this, and my hope is that you will read it. And I'm going to cut to the chase at the very end.
Okay.
I'm at the ground base. I work with kids. As a prevention specialist and a counselor in the school district, I'm responsible for 13 schools, and I conduct 17 support groups within those schools a week, plus all the other week work that I do. My concern has been what I've seen over the years I've been in education around the change in behavior of kids. I currently take two curriculums with me that I've put together, one on the media and violence in children, and another one on TV, Your Child's Friend or Foe. And I take that everywhere I can go, as many times as I can go, but I'm only one person. Somehow we need to get the information out. The real tragedy about this whole thing is the subtlety in which it works and the denial that this culture is in around how it affects kids. That's the baseline. The only way I know to change that is by educating. And I really think it's by educating the youth, because I think adults don't get it and they're not going to get it. I think it's going to be a generational shift. So I'm glad to see that this bill addresses parents, but I'm really glad to see that it's trying to put a curriculum together that's a common curriculum throughout the grades at schools, so that I don't have to go into a classroom like I did this morning to a sixth grade class, spend 90 minutes with sixth graders trying to explain to them how the brain and character development is affected by what they see and what they hear when they're young, and whether or not they should take a look at what they watch to see how they're going to turn out. With that, I just want to end, because what I'm really trying to change is best epitomized by a cartoon, by a comic strip, and you have it on your form. And if I would have known you had an overhead, I'd have brought in an overhead, but instead, I spent the time to do this. So I just want you to listen to this. This is really cool, because I've learned a lot from Calvin and Tom. They're going to continue. So the first statement, this, by the way, is what I call the Y2K child. Okay? First statement, I'm bored. By the way, I know you know this, but in the creative mind, there is no place for boredom. And one of the things they say is that the electronic culture has done to our kids is it's destroyed their creativity and imagination. But I'm bored. First statement. Let's go in.
But we've only been here a few minutes, Calvert. This is taking too long. What's the hurry? We've got all day, Calvert. Yeah, but it's kind of cold, and the sun's too bright, and my gloves are getting wet. When you think about it, building a snowman is a lot of work, and I didn't come out here to do something hard. And besides, what if the snowman doesn't turn out very good? We see failures, and who wants to be a failure? And even if it is good, what's the point? It was just a few weeks ago, melting, and it's all fuel. So instead of wasting my time, I'm going to go inside and pull down the sheet and watch TV. That way, complete comfort, physical comfort, I can vicariously experience the activity of actors pretending to do things. You sure it's not too much trouble to turn on the TV? Calvin, that's why we have remote control. Wow, virtual reality is already here. Calvin, I can't believe the only way to get inside is by walking. Now, I hate to tell you this, but this is not fun.
Yeah.
And it characterizes what the majority of young people like that I work with.
Mm-hmm.
I want to create a change.
Mm-hmm.
This is one way, I think, that we can do that. It's only one. It's only one. I know you probably know, but I'll just tell you because it was brought up before that the Kentucky killings in the school, that those families of those victims have now sued the entertainment industries for $130 million for video games he played, for a movie he fixated on, and for internet violent pornographic sites that he often frequented. There are real issues around this. By the way, they just tied in the paper this morning, the same movie that he fixated on is being tied into the killings now in Colorado. No? Basketball Diary. So with that, I'm finished. I'm in support of this as an educator, as a counselor.
Yes,
if you want to get things on the record, as I said, I really rare, but my next meeting is at 4.
Okay.
What he wants to do, what he wants to do with the committee.
I can just start you. Okay, I do need to leave. I'm sorry, but if you guys can stay for a while. I'm sorry it worked out this way because I, too, would love to stay and hear your presentation. This is a very important issue that we all need to be learning a lot more about. So.
Okay. I'm glad to see the school district putting up metrics. There was about 15 years ago, there was a big push in this area about the media and trying to be able to evaluate. And that kind of died away. Things, we go in cycles. And again, now we're at a crisis stage. We weren't at a crisis stage. We have just a concern about the media, but the crisis is really here. Jen, I don't know, am I creating a problem for you?
No, okay.
Are you okay?
Yeah.
Okay, why don't we, I'll grab the gavel and go to a subcommittee.
Mr. Chair, again, my apologies. I'm a fervent supporter of the bill.
Right.
I see this
on the... No, I understand.
Yeah.
I'm going to...
Thank you.
Close the full committee and open a subcommittee. Okay.
It doesn't really matter.
Okay. We'll just be official. We're beyond the...
Okay.
Do you need to leave? Do you need to leave?
No, I'm fine.
Okay. All right.
May I follow up on Mr. Sanchez briefly and draw your attention to the box on the back of the sheet that is passed out with many boxes on it. There are two boxes on the back. One is a resources box. The other box refers to the book that Hill Walker referred to on killing, and the parallels between what the media does in training children inadvertently to the very scientific way in which the military has now discovered to enable soldiers to kill when they need to. And there are very great similarities. They use social conditioning. The media uses social conditioning, and I shouldn't say uses because that implies intent, and I don't mean to imply that. But the children have heroes who act in violent ways, often outside of the law, which we've just been discussing. There's operant conditioning, and that is particularly pertains to video game playing, in which children, in quite realistic situations, learn to be violent such as in the Star Wars game I just saw a few weeks ago, where the if you are want to get ahead in the game and you become a dark Jedi, you have to kill Princess Leia. And you see Princess Leia right there, and you have your sword, and you kill Princess Leia to get ahead. This is nothing compared to some of the games. That's operant conditioning, and that's what the military uses to enable soldiers to kill. The military uses classical conditioning, where you associate pleasure and fun with violence and desensitizing yourself to violence. Well, what do we do when we send children to the movies and they watch R-rated movies? It's entertainment. They're there with a girlfriend or boyfriend, and they're drinking sodas, eating good food, not good food, but pleasant food. There you have classical conditioning. It's entertainment to view violence, and that's as it's used in the military. There is a safety catch the military uses in the training of their soldiers. They train soldiers to respect authority and obey authority. We don't have that in the media. And so children are being trained and able to kill without the safety catch.
I, having a bit of a military background, I was just, as you were talking about this, on killing and visualizing, and anyone who's gone through basic training or anything like that, you recall on the bayonet training, you know, you're sitting there and you're going after the dummy, and as you do it, so you're yelling, I'm a killer, I'm a killer, I'm a killer. And that's what you're yelling and doing that. It's your condition for that. But you could do it if you had to, but I don't remember any curial effect on my, I have no desire to do that at all. No, but it's, but I think you're right, the authority that is probably makes the big, you only do that if you're set in there to do that particular task, you know.
And not all children will be enabled to kill, trained to kill, but it's a risk factor, as Dr. Walker said.
I'm wondering right now if the, are you familiar with the paint gun concept right now?
It will be interesting to see.
Okay.
It will be very interesting to see the long run.
Well, I've been wondering about that, because neighborhood kids and a grandson of mine very interested in that, and they were playing out in our backyard with it. I kind of put a stop to it, but they were having a great time. You know, I watched that, and I remember having played soldier myself as a kid, you know, the cowboy Indian and the soldier and all that, and I've been thinking about it. I don't know what where that goes from there. I don't know if you folks have started worrying about that. Or
I think it's a mild form compared to the computer and video games that are being played. There's, you don't have the blood, you don't have the realism, which you do have in the electronic media.
So
these children are being active. They are socializing with peers. So just in degree, I would say, it isn't as strong a conditioner. That's just my opinion.
It's kind of a contest. I know they're having almost like an athletic contest that they have. Because they're just competing against each other now and so forth, and it's keeping them active, as you say. I've been having mixed feelings about it. I just don't know where I stand on it.
Senator Duncan, we talk about the violence issues and some of those things, but what I would really like to, since you've given me the time to do this, and I appreciate that, I would like to talk a little bit about you with the real issues that affect kids' behavior and learning in schools, which is where I am. It's interesting that Frontline ran a special on Ritalin abuse recently, and the prediction was that 1 out of every 10 children coming into the school system would be ADD, ADHD, and that 4 out of every 10 would be learning disabled. Have a learning disability. When you look at the whole issue around electronic media and how it affects kids, especially the stimulus issue, it's almost paradoxical because the more they watch and the more they're involved, the shorter their attention span issues become. And the 1 out of 10 is far above what would you look at a genetics, from a genetic standpoint. I'm a biologist first, and then I came into this in my later life. There are issues of its failing to promote logical sequential thinking, which causes problems in the long run about following directions and anticipating consequences, which is huge in the schools when you give directions and give consequential instructions, especially around discipline issues. So that issue's lost. a big 1992 reading survey throughout the United States correlated reading ability with television watching and said that the television watching kid, especially 4 to 6 hours, was greatly, greatly going to reduce their ability to read. 1997, here in Oregon, they did an eighth grade study with eighth graders and mathematics ability, correlated it exactly the same way. They said the best math students watched less than 1 hour a day. The worst watched more than six. The best readers watched less than 1 hour a day. The worst readers watched over six. It's phenomenal how it correlates to all those things and the way the brain learns, processes, and the way it's able to differentiate in the function. So from the standpoint of what I see in the changing behavior of children in schools, it's just amazing. Because these kids go home and they continue to watch TV, but what we do at school is we cut out recess time in order to get test scores up. It's unfathomable to me that we take the playtime away from kids to take test scores up in school, but we send them home to watch TV and play video games at home. And the problem is that the parents don't even know. It's a surrogate parent and a babysitter that is wonderful for them, but because it totally releases their responsibility around those issues. I think a lot of them would not do that, would they know that it affects their children from a chemical standpoint and from a learning standpoint the way that it does. And it's just the word's not getting out. It's just not getting out. And this bill does a lot to address that.
And, you know, I suppose we're all guilty of it nowadays. I mean, the baby said, I'm taking a big family dinner where, you know, nephews and nieces and grandchildren around. So, I mean, I caught myself buying a couple of videos to have around.
So that they can
some entertainment for kids, kind of keeps it busy, but, you know, it's
66% of families now watch TV while they eat dinner. And they say the art of dinner conversation among children is dead. In the Midwest, in Chicago, Minneapolis, they're providing special courses for young married couples on how to do family dinners. Isn't that fascinating? It's a cultural phenomenon.
I think as a contrast to my home, no one can leave the table to my everyone's just finishing. I still see my father. We all think we're done. I mean, my dad filling that cup of coffee, sitting back. I go, oh, gosh, one day we're going to quit. You know, to the contrast now where nobody sits down. In fact, our own kids, which we did sit at home, but our own children who are married now, get a kick out of their mom and dad because I get home about the time Jeopardy's on, and my wife is watching it. So we take our in deliberative, which we would never have allowed. We never would have allowed our kids to do, but you fall in these traps.
Mm-hmm.
And most parents don't know, really don't know, like you said, Mr. Sanchez.
Yeah.
I think I'd like to address the potential efficacy of this bill from a research perspective. We know about programs, from many programs that we followed and evaluated, that when you include the child and the parent in the program over a period of years, you have the greatest effectiveness, and we can change parental behavior as well as children's abilities and skills in this area. Parents that I have talked to, some of them are aware to some extent, and the more aware they are, the more isolated they feel because other parents aren't aware and aren't doing anything. So it's hard to change your habits when nobody else is changing their habits and you're worried that your child won't fit in the other children and, well, how can my child explain that he doesn't get to watch TV like the other children? So children parents are not empowered right now, but I think legislation like this could definitely empower parents to make changes together for the sake of their children's education. If it's tied to their children's education, they will, not all of them, but they will make changes, and it will change the tide at the beginning.
Has anyone done any research? Going back to the statement I made a while ago about the, if you think back, you go look at a 50s movie, even the advertisements for the movies, a Ronald Reagan movie with Ronald Reagan with a big cigarette. I'm a collector of stuff on presents, so I have that particular one. in movies, I'm serious, everyone smoked in the movies, men, women. That's when women were coming into the smoking area. And you don't see that now. Now, what happened that they pulled away from that? If they could do that for smoking, why can't it be done with the violence? Is someone looking at that? I think.
Well, Senator Duncan, what we have here, the only people that control media are the very people in the power structures that actually are the recipients of this huge cultural and lifestyle and brain process change. In other words, I was talking, I could list you anchormen and key personalities in media in Portland. They tell me, and they're key in media and television, on a network level. They cannot come down here and they cannot tell you that they personally believe that this is all true because it destroys the entire commercial base. In other words, you see, if they were to eliminate, which is not possible, but if they, in many cases they could, if they were to eliminate the process of this brain addiction that you've heard about. Starting at 2 years old, the child has 4 hours of video and television. 4 hours, starting at two, on average now. If they were to tell parents consistently, turn this off if your child has watched more than an hour a day, well, this would be impossible. It is impossible. Now, are their motives evil? Well, let's just say that their motives are compromised. They can't tell the truth, and they are the medium through which most people get all their truth, whatever that is. That's why in the bill, I stress, and in my testimony, I stress, we are in the media age. Our children are not in the information age. Our children are in the media age, much of which is disinformation and destructive. It is not truth. It is not good. It is media. And it does work in doing the objectives of advertising. See, Rachel went back to a conference where David Walsh, who is the president or chairman of the Family and Media Foundation, and he is the official AMA spokesman for the AMA on media. David Walsh said that the surveys of parents about the objectives and the nature of television show that parents have no clue about the industry's operations and motives.
Is there another meeting scheduled in here tomorrow?
No, not today.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. More
okay, go ahead.
And that when asked, what is the motive, the vast majority of parents say, well, the motive of medium or television is to entertain. When actually they reject the idea of what advertising itself says is the actual operations and motives of media. And that is to deliver eyeballs to advertisers, to deliver a stimulated conscious mind to the 30 or 60 second spot. And so they have to use what's called stimulus in its limbic system, not higher cortical function. Three things dominate primetime television: sex, violence, and humor. Typically, you are connecting two or three of those elements at the same time. It's assault, it's verbal assault, and sex in your typical male sitcom. Now, another interesting thing is that, and people are shocked, Bill Gallagher asked me on a show 2 nights ago about this bill in Portland. And I said, when a caller called in, you don't really understand the latest Nielsen ratings about 2- and 3-year-olds' favorite show, their top-rated show, second show, was Friends, which is an adult sitcom sexually laden with innuendo and insult. And that was the second most watched program by 2- and 3-year-olds. Why? Because parents bring the kids in or leave them around the TV and it spills over into their consciousness. And they just leave them there. So in terms of your question, the research and the way, in fact, the industry practice in our lifestyle leaves us vulnerable here, is fundamentally different than your experience and your observations about the smoking. The way in which smoking was identified by the Surgeon General as dangerous to human health, and then Congress banned advertising, actually did provide the leadership for the paradigm shift. Now, if this Senate, and then it goes to the House, and if the governor signs, and this bill really notifies that what we're talking about is permanent learning deficits at television and the loss of human potential and economic potential because we're getting brain-dumbed people, brain-damaged people. If this actually is done legislatively here, it will have an effect, as you're hearing from both of these presenters. But you see, we have a problem in taking something out of the medium when the medium itself, in its process, is what Americans are hooked onto. It's not exactly just changing an ad, like taking ads off of for one particular product. So I certainly want the others who are testifying or would like to discuss with you these matters, the school principal and some others, to be able to testify.
Did you want to respond today too?
Oh yes, I would like to end with this.
Okay.
Senator,
thank you very much,
Duncan. There are some people in the media who are honest and admit this, and I'd like to read you a quote by Bill Oakley, who is the producer of The Simpsons, just to show you the power and what they know of the power of this. Bill Oakley, when The Simpsons won out over The Flintstones as the longest-running cartoon sitcom in television history, he was interviewed, and this is what he said about his show. And I quote, "In 1990, it was quite shocking to have a sassy kid on TV. Now, every kid on TV is sassy, and every family is dysfunctional. It's amazing that behavior once considered outrageous isn't so outrageous anymore. You can now hear profanity at 10 p.m., so hearing Bart say, 'Eat my shorts,' or talk back to his teacher isn't so shocking." The real wow statement of his interview was this: "I guess America has changed around The Simpsons." Now, that's pretty fascinating for a producer of a show to say.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing.
Tell you how with it I am. I don't think I've ever seen
The Simpsons.
But I know The Simpsons.
Thank you.
You know, I do think and one that I turn off that channel immediately, even the beginning before you get turned off, is that what's that one called Marriage and
Marriage with
Children?
No.
I mean, looking for a relationship between a husband and wife. What is that? I can't stand anything. Would you please identify yourselves for the...
Go ahead. I'm Bill Roberts. I'm principal at Ventura Park School in the David Douglas School District, and I've been involved with Howard Davis on this project for about 3 years now. And it came about in a discussion that's been well stored in a lot of the documentation here, because I was also his son's principal at the time, who happens to be here today.
Oh.
And in dealing with Benjamin and his dad, we began to talk about a lot of different kinds of things, and it got piqued my interest and my frustrations that I was feeling as an educator and trying to deal with the things that I was seeing that have been well documented here by the previous speakers and by the documentation we got. I could give you kind of endless anecdotes about being a principal in the school and dealing with children and parents that support every comment that we've made. Some key things that I feel are important that I want to make over and above this is that I'm being asked as an educator now to raise the achievement levels of the kids that I'm working with. Your past history in education is, I think, well documented in the statements. I feel like I'm a little bit preaching to the choir here. In doing so, we're doing an awful lot of kinds of things to get those kids to do better on their test scores. But on the one hand, I get them at the maximum for instructional time a day for maybe 5 hours at the intermediate level, 4.5 hours at the primary level, and we're trying to compete with an equal or greater amount of time with television watching or dysfunctional family relationships or all of the above to try to keep these kids focused on getting a good education. Recently, I'm getting to the age now where I'm hiring teachers that are younger than my children, and I'm asking 23 and 24-year-old teachers to try to explain to parents what good parenting is, and they have no children of their own and probably aren't even married. And
they've been watching these TV shows so much themselves.
And a lot of them, though, I think have a sense after working with kids for a short period of time that something isn't quite working here. And where is all this going? I'm not here to tell you that this legislation is going to keep things like Thurston and Columbine High School from happening. They're too complex issues for us to make that grandiose statement. But we've got to start turning things around. We've got to start going the other direction to keep this from happening not once a year, but who knows where it can end up, you know, once a week. The journey takes one step. This I see as one step in starting to turn around the trends that are going on in our culture in this country. And part of it is driven by ignorance. And it's ignorance at all levels. I have educators who are children of the television age that have trouble understanding the impact that I'm dealing with and what I'm talking about. And some of them probably right in the office, the old guy and all these things. I mean, there's always that generational thing. The other piece of it is that education alone can't do it. And that's why we've gone to the trouble of expanding it and adding a parent training component, because I feel while as educators, if we get an effective curriculum and we get the support from the state and we have 10 years to turn around the 50 years that have got us where we're at, that can probably happen. And in each successive generation should do better at dealing with this. But to slow that down as quickly as possible, the parent component would at least start getting parents to think about some of the things they're doing and start making some adjustments and possibly believe that it's not just the school people that are telling them that what's happening with television isn't good for their kids, but other places are speaking to that issue too. And that's why I see both half of this legislation as being key. We need to be able to speak to both audiences, educators and children and their parents at the same time, to start this process and kind of kickstart this process into action. The number of parents in all socioeconomic groups in my school right now is probably about as average as you can get in the state. I've got 18% ESL families. I've got 56% free and reduced lunch. I'm running about 5% cultural diversity and about 18% racial diversity in my school. I've got a mean household income of about $29,000. And yet, and we're struggling to get our test scores. We're just a notch or two below the state on these things. And I sit and look at the things that are impacting these kids day in and day out. The attention spans, the being able to focus and adjust. One of the things that I'm finding teachers having to do to get those kids to focus on math, to focus on reading skills, is we're starting to teach them the way that they seem to be the only way they can learn. I'm afraid that education is going to slip into supporting the system, because if my goal is that I've got to get my test scores up, and I can't do it the traditional way, which is to spend 45 minutes really drilling my kids on math skills, because they can only handle 10 or 15 minutes at a time if I'm lucky, then I start teaching it that way. And I'm afraid we're going to slip into educating everybody into that mode. I don't think that's going to be effective. My heart tells me that that's not going to get us to where we want to be. And then I start looking at the comparisons that are going on in education. This country is very good at doing lots of research. Recently, a pretty articulate high school student at Gresham, in making a speech for the governor out there about needs for education, talked about that the United States does more educational research than the rest of the world put together, but we also ignore more educational research than the rest of the world putting together. And that's such a profound statement out of the mouth of the day, so to speak. It's just like, you know, it really rocked me. It's exactly right. We've had this research going on for years. We've had the data, the impact of the media and so forth. I was drafted for Vietnam and joined the Air Force and was a medic. And my realities of growing up playing Army around Rose City Golf Course with some of the guys that developed G.I. Joes and all of the Korean War we had, and then to go to Vietnam and see the issues of what a Claymont mine can do to somebody, and to be riding on an airplane day after day after day with thousands of these guys coming back from Vietnam, the reality of the war, the reality of the training that you have, those juxtaposition kinds of things really shocking them to where it's at. When I was a kid playing war, Everybody got shot, everybody died, and we got up and went home. That didn't work when I went through the real thing. My scare now is that that has been taken so many steps farther down the road. And your question about the paintball games and so forth, I think if all the kids were doing was competing in a game and the challenge of bettering somebody else, we have all kinds of sports that do that. I wouldn't be worried about paintball, but it's the idea that we have to use some form of a weapon to prove our superiority. Where when I was a kid, the weapon was hiding in the dark and playing hide-and-go-seek or kick the can, and it was my ingenuity to find a good hiding spot and create a way to get away. Kids don't play those games in the door, and they don't even understand the concept.
Those things cost hundreds of dollars. I mean, those are very expensive.
Well, to keep me entertained in the summertime, along with about 40 of my friends, all we needed was a 3-pound coffee can sitting in the middle of the lawn someplace and a tolerant neighborhood that would let us run around hiding in the bushes and stuff in the dark. And kids don't use that kind of creativity anymore, and it doesn't function anymore in school. We highlight limited kids that do show some of this creativity, and we glamour over the 10% that do it, where I believe that we should be doing it over 50-60% that have the same capacity, but because so much of the stuff is affecting them, isn't allowing them to show it. So basically my request at this point is that if you want me to raise standards, if you want me to continue to get the things done and get our kids to the levels that we want, I need tools to work with. And one of the tools I need is a way to educate my students and my parents about what's being done to them through the use of television and media. And right now there isn't a resource out there that's going to give me that in any kind of useful, extended way that would effectively reach all grade levels and parents at the same time. And I don't see that happening unless we step up and do it. And nowhere else in the country can I find a place that's put an effort together as complete as this to try to get it accomplished. And frankly, I'm proud to be an Oregonian, and it's kind of nice for us to be on the cutting edge once in a while. And I think this is a chance for us to step up and do some of that. So, thank you.
Comment and a question. Okay. I was just thinking that how times do change. I have a picture in my office of my fifth grade class, my first class. You can find me. I look almost like the kids in there, but
I've had some of those.
I've changed. And I look at that class, and I know them all. I knew their parents. I could probably call their parents if I go. I can name every one of them. I can tell their parents and who they were and whether their mother worked or whatever happened. You know, I knew that class. You take my fifth grade class, I think they're about 26 in that picture. You take it probably in the fifth grade from your school or any other school now. It's a different world. And the problem I have, even with some of my colleagues here, I'm constantly reminding you, we're dealing with a different world completely. And people forget that a little bit. You can't say, well, I don't know why we can't go back to the good old days. You can't. You've got to change the structure of homes and all these other factors. But we have to start. Now, I'm not trying to alibi out. I'm just saying we have to do things differently than we've ever done before.
And I'm not saying to give up television by any means.
No.
I think it's
you can't do it.
It's a tool that we've learned how to abuse it. Now we need to learn how to use it.
Because it could be a great it's a great educational tool, too. But we have to use it right. No, I agree.
Well,
another question.
Interesting statistic that goes on. You're talking about parents and kids and stuff. One of the things that media has convinced many of my parents is that they need to be two-income households to have all the products that they see that they're being pushed. Recently, there was I think it was McNeil Air Report pointed out that IRS came out and indicated that about 40% of the two-income families in this country have less disposable income because two people are working because of the cost of child care, extra vehicles, insurance, all the things that go into having two people out of the home working, and that if one of them would just stay home and take care of the kids, they'd have more disposable income. And yet, I think part of the reason we continue to do that is the media keeps telling us over and over again that everybody's got to be out there working. There are some other issues that I deal with a lot, which is the fact that we supposedly have such a great unemployment rate in the state, but an awful lot of those $29,000 income families that I've got,
two families,
two parents are working,
yeah,
6 days a week, 10 hours a day for $455 an hour, and we tried to raise it, and a lot of them are going backwards because they're working jobs where they may or may not get things, and so they're not around. I mean, to provide that much of an income just to keep their kids fed and clothed And then for me to come and complain that your kids can't be watching TV, the parents say, what can I do? But I'm not home to take care of it anyway.
And I sympathize with them, too. I understand them. Oh, one quick question. How many of your classes right now do not teach phonics?
Well, I'm lucky to say that all of mine do, and my district has for some time. I left Portland after 17 years in 1990 and went to David Douglas because I got frustrated with the bureaucracy and the pendulum swing and went to a district that is smaller and a little more conservative. I'm also proud to say that when North Clackamas got rid of the teachers that taught my kids to be musicians, my district hired them all, and we still have band and orchestra, and I provide PE and a full licensed librarian. Yes, I do. And you used to come read to my son at Riverside. We're in the library there. So we do have a community connection that you're not aware of. But I'm very proud of my district. It's done an awful lot of good things, but we've got long ways to go to get the things we need to do. We're still struggling with trying to find a reason why we can't get our test scores up, where we're getting a lot of other things in place, and I think this is one of the fundamental things we're talking about.
And we're still, by the way, have grandkids in that school. Another one will be, one leaves the sixth grade this year, we'll be in another one will be in kindergarten next year.
Well, my kids both live in that area now, and my son's going to get married, my daughter already is, so I may have grandkids in those schools too. So.
it does happen, I can assure. Yes.
Okay, Senator Duncan, it's kind of an ironic historical treat to address instead of the Committee of the Whole, which the Constitutional Convention broke down into in 1787, it's the Committee of One.
The Committee of One.
We appreciate you spending the extra time for us.
And I did, and I realize, you know, something nice that you're preaching to the choir, because I kind of understand this a little bit and committed. But I think it's good. It officially gets on the record, and I think that's important to hear too.
I'm Randy Stiver. I'm a colleague of Howard's, and I've been involved with the media literacy movement for nearly as long as Bill and Howard have been involved with it back about 3 years ago. As a parent volunteer in the school system, I was for 3 years a parent staff president and on the parent advisory committee to the principal in Roseburg in a middle school and high school. Now I'm on the site council down at Sheldon in Eugene, Sheldon High School, and on the Internet Guidelines Committee for the 4J system as well as parent. Plus, I have a daughter who's just graduating, will be at the Honors College down at the U of O, so we're kind of happy about that. I just wanted to touch on just a couple of points. From my perspective as a parent, just to add a little bit, and the question has been tossed out as people try to talk off this subject, which is, it takes a little bit of creativity and mental effort to comprehend, but when they're busy watching TV, it's hard to drum that up. And the question that's often asked is, why don't parents teach their kids how to evaluate and limit their children's use of TV and computers and media and that sort of thing? And the answer is, largely, parents don't know. You know, the old proverb from the Bible, train up a child in the way he should go. When he's old, he won't depart.
Yeah, excuse me, I have a question. This will excite a little bit. Will you be offended? Another committee comes in here at 4 o'clock. Jan has to have this room cleaned up and cleared. Would you be bothered if she is starting to move that on? Yeah, she'll keep listening.
No, that's no problem.
It's going to help, because that next committee starts right at 4.
I only need another half a minute.
You keep going.
Very right.
I'll keep my corner right here, and I'll clean it up.
Okay.
You can start getting the rest of it ready for the next group.
Well, the proverb from the Bible that says, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he won't depart from it, also applies to the way a child should not go. And today, we have young parents who are second and third generation TV kids. So they don't.
Teachers who are too.
Yeah, they didn't learn the critical media thinking skills at home. They certainly didn't learn it at school. So how can we expect them now to teach their kids what they don't know? And I think that's really the key with the Media Literacy and Parent Support Act. Is we need to be taught in the schools, and we need to have the parent component. And of course, it's an opportunity for volunteers to be involved on a large scale basis. As a pastor, I understand working with volunteers quite a lot. And I think that this can address a really pressing need. It isn't panacea, and it doesn't solve everything, but it begins to solve something. And in a sense, as Bill commented, it's an opportunity for Oregon to be on the cutting edge, or another way of looking at it. It's an opportunity to make a new Oregon trail for media literacy in that sense, too, sort of blaze a trail that other states can follow and that our own citizens in this state can follow. So I think there's a lot that can be said, that should be said for the proposed Senate bill, and certainly I want to support it and encourage its furtherance. It's a crying need, a very urgent need for our children all across the state in every way.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Is there anyone else who wants to comment today? Let you wrap up. Thank you very much for your testimony. And by the way, it's really great to have the kids here today, too.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever been to legislature before? Do you think you'll ever want to go again?
Well, in closing, Senator Duncan, I know that Hill Walker, who is just outside, who presents very well, and by the way, the Institute on Violence and Destructive Behavior at the University of Oregon, having become very knowledgeable in this field of youth interventions, which came from their professional background dealing with autistic and handicapped children, they wanted me to say again to you that both Hill and Jeff Sprague, co-directors at the university and that institute, they want you to know, back this 100% or 1,000%. They think this is fundamental, this kind of approach toward parenting education and systemic education on the effect of media and the knowledge of the brain, the knowledge on health, the knowledge, and if you start at kindergarten, and by the way, there are components that start right away in the second week of kindergarten in this bill, the way it would be put together, the way it was discussed and envisioned, it would have a dramatic impact.
But even based on what you said earlier, that's late.
Oh, in fact, yes.
You're only about 5 years late.
Well, the parenting education stuff starts at zero.
Yeah.
And that's why all the 0-3 proposals, I know Senator Gordon has, this bill envisions actually creating the curriculum that would be used and funded and disseminated that several bills are now talking about, early childhood and all these different programs. I've talked to all the parent education, the actual people in the state that provide the curriculum for those early intervention programs or those Healthy Start programs. There is no common curricula. Under this bill, it would create the curricula that would be brain knowledge-based, best practice for parenting at whatever point, from infancy to the toddlers all the way through to preschool and through preschool into school, so that the media component, which is a huge problem at that age, as well as healthy brain and all the developmental issues, would be communicated in a continuous platform. In other words, all these different things and ideas are floating out here, and as I've pointed out on the House side, what is needed is a continuous approach toward parents that is articulated at a high level in this state and provides step-by-step awareness. So I think that's very nice, having talked to all the different folks about pulling these together.
And notice, you know, you have the Pediatric Association here on point.
I
remember years ago, at one point, getting the state PCA involved,
mm-hmm.
and we were trying to get, as a parent was leaving the hospital, they were given a book.
Yeah.
The emphasis was on the importance of reading to your children. Well, I was just thinking, you know, maybe, now, nowadays people don't stay in the hospital. I mean, they may just go have a baby and then go home. But somehow or other, if you can get that in the prenatal.
We are going to do that.
So that whole concept would be out there.
Exactly.
You're catching them people at a vulnerable time when they read. So that's, yeah.
That, by the way, is a part of this architecture.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's
the zero. All at the hospital and the Healthy Start. Are you familiar with the Clackamas County, or particularly Multnomah County, has a Healthy Start where an RN goes into every, but they don't have this particular curriculum.
So this part of the syllabus could get in there.
This would be suffused right at all those levels.
Well, I think we do have even a bill with the visiting nurse,
mm-hmm.
through prenatal and that whole thing.
But they don't have this piece, but they want it.
Yeah. My concern now is that probably have to make it a video game to get them to deal with it.
Well, I think you're right. Yeah, it's the irony of the whole thing is probably within it, probably in a very small segment. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And then every year you could just add to it.
Extend it.
You can extend it. You're going to become so effective that they'll be able to go from 10 to 12 minutes. Well, folks, it's been a
It's been a very interesting afternoon. One of the problems we have in the legislature, we spend all the time sitting in meetings all day, and our attention span gets kind of narrow sometimes.
Thank you for your work.
You've done a very good job of keeping me awake all the time. I did have a cup of coffee at one point, but I do appreciate the time and the effort that you folks have put in, and it may be maybe 10 years before we see the results, but
we might
got to
much
start.
Sooner in some ways. Hope it's much sooner. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay,
let's touch base before you take off.
Is there a meeting?
Oh, yes, I better adjourn. I'm going to adjourn.